flesh was as clammy as his. For a long time, they merely hugged, shivering as their minds and bodies tried to relax. Dakian had a hand cupped over one tiny breast. Sarah lay in the curve of his arm, lightly tracing the line of his lips with a forefinger. "It's probably a good thing I'm not on Takis."
"Why?"
"I'd have been dead long ago if a mere human, a groundling, can't outmaneuver me at the Takisian game." He shook his head.
"Which is?"
"Intrigue. I've known Hartman for 20 years, and I never suspected.
He was very cunning. I've spent..."
Her voice deepened and thickened with bitterness.
"And ruined my life pursuing him."
"And now you've succeeded? Was it worth it?"
"I don't know."
She sighed, and he kissed her.
Dakian barked out a short laugh, then muffled a groan.
"I have no idea where my 13-year-old grandson is. Isn't that incredible? I'm so damned busy strutting about the grand stage of life that I have no time to live. I wonder what it would be like to be just a person."
"Boring. You'd hate it."
Easing up on an elbow, Tak stared down at her. "Do you think so?"
"Yes."
He laid back down. "I don't know. Do I have a wife? Children? Friends?"
"You have friends."
"I think I lost most of them tonight."
Sarah began to cry again. "I'm sorry. It's all my fault."
Dakian laid a hand over her mouth. "No, that's my line.
Ricky loved me, and he had him cut to pieces. I never even slept with him."
The alien slid his hand down her stomach, matted his fingers in her mons. "Then let us honor the dead by celebrating living."
"Isn't that a little callous?"
"Hush, Sarah. You think too much."
2 a.m. Jack was sweating as he sat up in bed, his back propped against thick hotel pillows. A half-empty bottle of whiskey stood in his hand. He'd run through 2 packs of Camels. The television was on, an old Boris Karloff suspense film. Karloff kept looking at Jack with James Spector's eyes. Jack turned the set off with remote control. The television kept staring at him, so he got out of bed and turned the TV set to the wall. He knew what he had to do. He didn't know if he had the nerve to do it. He'd never done this kind of thing by himself before. There'd always been Mr. Holmes, or Earl, or someone to give him advice and make sure everything worked out all right. The secret ace had already come close to killing him, twice. Third time, he wondered, the charm?
10 a.m. Dakian was seated in front of the room service tray buttering a slice of toast when Jay emerged from the bedroom. He wore one of Tachyon's suits, and though it was too short in the arms and legs, the man looked decidedly more elegant and well-kept. Blaze stretched out across an armchair, looked up, and snickered. Dakian gave his grandson a stern look. "Blaze, did you enjoy your little ride on the luggage carousel?" The boy looked sullen.
"No, I felt stupid."
"Then by the ideal, you will mind your manners," Dakian told him, "or I will have Mr. Aykroyd teleport you back to the Atlanta airport."
"I can't help it if he's funny," Blaze complained. "He looks like a fruit."
"Those are my clothes," Dakian pointed out stiffly. "Myself, I think it is a dramatic improvement."
"I'm with the kid," Jay said.
Blaze looked surprised. Then he grinned. Jay whipped up his finger in a quick draw move. Blaze flinched.
"Gotcha,"
Jay said. He smiled. So did Blaze.
Dakian watched this in confusion. Apparently teleporting his wayward heir halfway across Atlanta had established a rapport. He remembered George once telling him that Blaze needed to fear someone before he could care for them. Tak felt depressed.
"He's enough of a rapscallion without your encouraging him," Dakian muttered.
"Ah, he's okay,"
Jay said, pulling a chair over to the room service cart.
For Dekesian.
He lifted the silver dome off his plate and attacked the eggs Benedict wolfishly. Tachyon was patting his lips with a napkin, and Jay was mopping up the last of the yolk with a piece of toast when the knock came at the door. Tachyon stood.
Who's there? Carnifex, open up. I have all day.
Tachyon glanced back at Jay.
Let him in, the detective said. Ray's tough, but there's nothing he can do against you, me, and the Cisco kid over there.
He gestured toward Blaze. The alien nodded and opened the door. Carnifex glanced around and stepped into the suite, wearing his skin-tight, white uniform that outlined every muscle and tendon in his body.
Regs say we're supposed to stay out of the political bullshit, Ray told Tachyon with disdain. Good for you, otherwise I'd have to whip your ass. You've been hanging around Braun too much, I guess. Some of it must have rubbed off.
Tachyon's mouth tightened.
Say what you came to say, Ray, he told the government ace. Your opinions on political and moral issues interest me, not in the slightest. Greg wants to see you. The sentiment is not reciprocated. You'll see him, Ray said with a crooked smile. Greg said to tell you he has a proposition he wants to discuss.
I have nothing to discuss with the senator.
Scared? Ray wanted to know. Don't worry, I'll hold your hand if you want, he shrugged. Come or don't come, either way, it's no skin off my nose, but if you don't, you're going to regret it.
The ace in the white suit looked around the suite. At the windows, Turtle had shattered. The television Hiram had dropped, the urine stain on the sofa.
Must have been a hell of a party, he said to Tachyon. Somebody ought to teach you to clean up after yourself, Doc. This place is a mess.
He was going out the door when Aykroyd called out,
Hey, Carney!
Tachyon winced. Ray turned around with a dangerous glint in his green eyes.
That's Carnifex, asshole.
Carnifex, asshole, Jay repeated. Tachyon winced again and closed his eyes.
I'll try and remember, Jay continued. How many of those good humor suits you own?
6 or 8, Carnifex said suspiciously.
Why? Must be hell to get the bloodstains out, Jay said.
Tachyon couldn't believe he was hearing this. As a child, Aykroyd must have enjoyed kicking over anthills and investigating beehives.
Ray glared at the detective. Stay out of my way, Seamus, he said, or you'll find out firsthand. He slammed the door behind him.
Seamus, Jay said. He actually called me Seamus. God, I'm so mortified. He turned to Tachyon.
You gonna go?
Tach straightened and lifted his chin.
I must.
Jay sighed. I was afraid you were gonna say something like that.
Maybe he'd got some sleep. Maybe he'd just passed out from time to time. He figured he'd better do what he had to do before all motor coordination went to hell and he couldn't punch the numbers on his cellular phone. The Reverend Barnett, please. May I say who's calling? The female voice spoke with a heavy Spanish accent. This is Jack Braun. The accented voice was prim. The Reverend Barnett is not available to anyone, Mr. Brown. He's in a prayer vigil expected to last until... He'll talk to me! Jack's voice rose to a near shout. Sir, with feigned patience, the Reverend Barnett. Tell him, Jack said, that I can deliver California. There was a long pause before the voice returned. I will connect you to Miss Van Rensselaer. Little hangover stilettos entered Jack's eyes at the mention of the name. At least he was getting closer to the Reverend.
He's coming. Puppet Man could sense Tachyon's arrival from Billy Ray's disgust. We're making a mistake not trying to take him. No, Greg was vehement. He's too strong for us. If we attack him that way, he'll have an excuse to retaliate. My way's better. You're weak. You're feeling guilty. The accusation was too close. Yes, he was feeling guilty. He'd known Tachyon for 20 years, after all. Just shut up, he told Puppet Man. Let me handle this. Sure, sure. Who else has he told? Hiram knows. Maybe lots of others. Shut up! Greg was facing out of the window as Billy, with obvious ill will, ushered Tachyon into the suite. One traitor for you, Senator, Ray said as he held the door open. Wonder how much they paid the little creep. Ray shut the door behind Tachyon so closely that the alien had to step quickly into the room or have it strike his leg. Greg continued to shuffle through the pages of the folder he held in his hands, slowly and deliberately turning the pages. He waited until he heard Tachyon sniff in irritation.
Say whatever it is you want to say, Senator. I do not have a great deal of time to waste on you.
The words hurt more than they should have. I didn't do those things, he wanted to say. Puppet Man did them. But he couldn't say that because Puppet Man was listening. He turned around to face the red-haired alien and tossed the folder on the coffee table in front of Tachyon.
Damned interesting reading matter, that, he said. Go on, Doctor. Pick it up.
Tachyon glared, but he snatched up the folder with delicate fingers. He riffled through the pages stamped with Justice Department seals and shrugged.
What is it, Senator? Play out this farce and be done with it.
It's simple enough, Doctor. Hartman seated himself in one of the chairs, lounging back. He put his feet on the coffee table with studied nonchalance. You invaded my mind and took ammunition to use against me. I don't like being stuck with an empty revolver in a duel, so I went looking for things about you. I wondered who was whispering about me in your ear. I wondered where the lies might have come from.
They are not lies, Senator. I saw the disgusting, perverted filth in your head. We both know that.
Please, Puppet Man begged at the insult. Let me try.
No.
Greg waved a hand.
Someone convinced you to rape my mind, Doctor. I know Hiram was partially involved, but Hiram really wants to believe in me. He's not the source. My guess was that it had to be Sarah. And if it was Sarah, she might have been working in concert with someone else. You see, I know Kahina. You remember poor Kahina, Doctor, had talked with Sarah. I know she and Gimli had had contact with another man, a Russian. I even had a photograph. And I have friends in high places. Remember, Doctor? They checked a few other things out for me. Checked backgrounds and chronologies. You'd be surprised at what they'd found. Or then maybe, just maybe, you wouldn't.
Greg shook his head. He gave Tachyon the famous crooked half-smile that had become the cartoonist icon for Hartman.
It's actually ironic, isn't it, Doctor? The HUAC folks were right all along. You always were a goddamn communist from outer space.
Tachyon had gone white. His body shook. His lips were pressed together into a hard line. Puppet Man caught the overflow of emotions and chuckled.
Got him. We got him.
Bang, Greg said. You see, I've got a few bullets, too. One called Blaze, and one called Polyakov. And other names. Very high-caliber ammo.
You can prove nothing, Tachyon blustered.
Your own people say Polyakov is dead. Kahina is dead. Gimli is dead. Everyone you touch seems to be dead. All you have is hearsay and innuendo. No facts.
Polyakov has been seen here in Atlanta. The other facts would be easy enough to find, Greg told him comfortably. But I don't want to go to the trouble.
And what is it you do want?
You know that as well as I do, Doctor. I want you to say you made a mistake. I want you to tell the press and the delegates that it was all a private misunderstanding between me and you, and that everything's patched up again. We're friends. We're pals. And you'd sure as hell be disappointed if everyone didn't vote for me. If you don't want to actively campaign for me, fine. Leave Atlanta after you make your statement to the press. But if you don't do that, I will start digging for those facts you're so casually dismissing. You might take the nomination away from me, Tachyon, but I'll make sure you get dragged down with me. You and that upstart grandson as well. It had worked. Greg was certain of it. Tachyon blustered wordlessly. His fists clenched around the folder so that the cardboard crumpled, bright spots of color on his cheeks. The prissy little wimp was about to goddamn cry, his eyes welling with tears.
We've won. Even if all he does is keep his mouth shut, we've won. We'll be okay, you see? Greg told Puppet Man. And after this is over, we'll find a way to take him out, finally and permanently.
Tachyon was crying, a line of wetness trailing down from both eyes. He drew himself up like a bantam rooster, his chest puffed up, and he glared at Hartman. Greg laughed scornfully. We have a deal, then? Greg said. Good. I'll have Amy set up the press conference.
No,
Tachyon said. He hurled the folder at Greg, paper scattered like ghostly autumn leaves.
No,
Tachyon said again, and this time it was a defiant, weeping shout.
You may do as you wish, Senator, but no, you may go to hell. And as for your threats to take me with you, I don't care. I have been there before.
Tachyon turned to leave as Greg shot to his feet. Puppet Man howled inside, frantic.
You son of a bitch, he screamed at Tachyon. You stupid bastard! All I had to do was make one phone call and you're finished. You'll lose everything!
Tachyon glared back at Greg with smoldering violet eyes.
I lost everything important long ago, he told Greg. You can't threaten me with that.
Tachyon opened the door, sniffed loudly, and closed it with silent dignity behind him.
He awoke to the sound of the door opening. Spectre was lying under his bed. He'd spent the night there, afraid to sleep in the open. He peered out through the inch-tall gap between the carpeted floor and the edge of the bedspread. A pair of brown, buckle-down shoes walked past and clopped onto the tiled bathroom floor.
Nobody in here again last night, it was a black woman's voice. Wasting our goddamn time on this junk. Guess I better call the man and tell him.
That's what they said to do, said a voice from the hall. So I do it about you.
The feet moved over next to the bed. Spectre held his breath. The woman lifted the receiver and punched in four numbers, waited.
He's never at his desk. Always wanting to be with the delegates or Secret Service. She cleared her throat.
Yes, sir. This is Charlene up in 1031. There was nobody here last night. Of course I'm sure. You know we smell whiskey the first night he was in, but not since.
A long pause.
Yes, sir. We'll keep an eye on the room.
She hung up the phone.
Asshole.
There was laughter from the hallway. The woman walked back toward the door.
You know, if we're going to do this spy shit, I think we should get paid extra for it. Don't see why we should bust our asses to make Mr. Hotshot Hastings shine.
She closed the door. Spectre could hear the woman carrying on outside the room. Even a New Yorker would have trouble getting a word in edgewise with her. He was dead tired. His jaw felt like it had been stuck back on with tenpenny nails. Moving would take more effort than he was willing to make right now. He closed his eyes and listened to the maid's cart squeak its way down the hall.
Breakfast of steak and coffee hadn't quite done the job of making Jack ready to face the Reverend Barnett and a stable of killer aces, but a couple last-minute shots of vodka had. They'd steadied his hands for shaving. Not that he could have cut himself if he tried, since even the wicked cutthroat he used couldn't match his protective wild card, but he hated to do a sloppy job. While he dressed, he watched the news. Today's first ballot had Hartman down by 200. About 30 of Jack's own delegates had defected, some to Dukakis, some to Jackson. Barnett was up about 40 votes total. A new sense of urgency poured through Jack. He dressed in his summer power suit of navy blue cotton, handmade by an old man in New Jersey he'd been going to for 40 years, a light blue aero shirt, black Italian wingtips, red tie. He never understood why power ties were supposed to be yellow now, since yellow ties always made him think of someone who'd been careless with his breakfast eggs. He put on heavy Hollywood shades, partly to hide his hangover, partly in case demise was waiting for him somewhere, and took another welcome shot of vodka before he left. He'd buy some cigarettes in the lobby. Barnett's limousine met him at the door. The traffic was impossible, complicated by marching jokers and Catholics for Barnett, and mutants for Zippy the Pinhead, and shuttle buses disgorging journalists from the outlying hotels where they'd been quartered. Fleur met him at the door to the Omni Hotel. His nerves did a little dance at the sight of her, but he managed to repress his urge to flee, and instead smiled and shook her hand. "I have an elevator waiting," she said. "Fine." They stepped across the polished lobby floor. "I apologize for any difficulty Consuela gave you. She's used to fielding calls from cranks." "No problem." "She's a refugee from the anti-Ladino persecutions in Guatemala, a poor young widow with three children. The Reverend made it possible for her to stay in this country." Jack turned to Fleur and smiled. "That's remarkable, that a man as busy as the Reverend Barnett would take the time to help someone like that." Fleur looked into his deep black shades. "The Reverend's like that. He cares." "Not just the Reverend, I'm sure. You've been possessed by the spirit of charity yourself, I'm sure." Fleur tried to look modest. "Well, I mean sacrificing your chastity just to cure old Tack of his problem." She stared at him, goggle-eyed. "By the way, just between us," Jack grinned. "Did he ever manage to get it up?" Jack, smiling, followed a white-lipped Fleur out of an elevator whose temperature seemed to have dropped about 50 degrees. "Secret Service people, Lady Black among them, prowled the long corridor leading to Barnett's suite. Jack hoped she didn't recognize him. He passed by a busy suite filled with tables and campaign workers. Most of them seemed to be women, many of them young and attractive. They came to a door, and Fleur knocked. Leo Barnett, looking younger than his 38 years, opened the door and stuck out his hand. "Welcome, Mr. Braun," he said. Jack stared at the hand, wondering if Barnett could take his mind by touching him. And then, summoning nerve from somewhere, he reached out and took the hand.
He was shaking again. Tachyon paused, the glass almost to his lips, and considered. How many drinks did this make for the morning? 2, 3? He set the glass aside with overly broad gestures, patted it firmly as if to keep it in place, to keep it from flying back to his hand, crossed to the ravaged room service breakfast tray, and took a bite of cold toast. His stomach revolted. Gasping, cold sweat breaking at his hairline, the alien staggered into the bathroom and sluiced water over his face. From the bedroom he could hear Blaze and Aykroyd talking, laughing. Crossing to the bedroom, Tachyon opened the door. The conversation broke off. Jay looking up inquiringly, Blaze with a brooding light in those strange purple-black eyes. "Mr. Aykroyd, come in here, please. I need to talk to you." Jay shrugged, tried to pull down the pants that hiked up above his ankles, followed Tachyon into the sitting room. "What did Hartman want?" he asked as he poked at the room service tray. "Mr. Aykroyd, I require a favor of you."
"Sure, name it."
Tachyon lifted a hand.
"Do not be so quick to commit yourself. Having me in your debt may not be enough to outweigh what I will ask of you."
"Jesus Christ, get to the point, Tachyon. All this flowery Tachyon bullshit."
Jay sank his teeth into an orange slice and tore away the meat.
"Hartman is blackmailing me. I have refused to meet his demands, but I require time. A day, 2 at the most, and it will be over. Hartman will have lost the nomination."
Tack's voice ran down, and he stared blankly into an eternity of blasted hopes, gave himself a shake, and resumed,
"You can give me that time."
"The point, the point?"
"You must remove a man from Atlanta. The more conventional means are closed to us."
Suspicion bloomed in the detective's eyes.
"Why? Who is this guy?"
The abandoned drink came easily to his hand. The beaded glass cool against his palm, Tack drained the brandy in a long swallow.
"Long ago, I was saved from death by a man who has alternately been a devil and an angel to me."
Aykroyd threw his hands into the air.
"Shit!"
"This is difficult for me," Tachyon flared.
He rolled the glass between his hands, then burst out.
In 1957, I was recruited by the KGB. He smiled sadly at Aykroyd's expression. It wasn't all that difficult. I would have done anything for a drink. At any rate, years passed. I proved to be less useful than originally hoped. They cut me loose, and I thought I was free. Then last year, the man who ran me, those many long years ago, re-entered my life and called the debt. He's here, in Atlanta. Why? Hartman. He suspected the existence of the monster. Now Hartman has found out about him, and our connection. Connection? He is Blaze's tutor. Oh, hell. Aykroyd dropped into a chair. This is the bludgeon with which Hartman seeks to cow me. I am probably going to jail, Mr. Aykroyd, but I'll see him stopped before I go.
You want me to pop this guy away?
Yes. Already the FBI and the Secret Service have been alerted. They're combing Atlanta for George.
Are you still a commie?
Tachyon laid fastidious fingers against the lace at his throat. One slender copper eyebrow arched arrogantly. I consider Mr. Aykroyd. The detective eyed the slim peacock figure dressed in green, orange, and gold. Yeah, I get your drift. He slapped his hands onto his thighs and pushed up from the chair.
Well, hey, it's all ancient history to me. Let's go pop this commie somewhere.
Tachyon opened the door to the bedroom.
Blaze. You're taking him? I mean, he knows?
Of course. Come, child. I want you to have a chance to say farewell to George.
Here Jack had come in his power suit, hoping to impress the well-dressed conservative preacher he'd seen on the tapes. And instead, Leo Barnett looked about as formal as Jimmy Carter slapping around the house in Plains. Barnett was dressed in worn jeans, a checked shirt, and black Keds. His razor-cut blonde hair was slightly disordered. He shambled back into his room and stuck his hands in his pockets. Would you like breakfast? I believe there's plenty left on the buffet. Jack looked around the room where Barnett had spent his prayer vigil. It was an ordinary hotel suite, with a little kitchenette, a wet bar, a big TV, even a hooded fireplace with some rolled newspaper logs. All the light was artificial. The curtains were drawn, as per Secret Service instructions. A picture of Barnett's fiancée stood on one table. A Macintosh too sat on a table, and there was a silver-streamed table on wheels near the door, presumably with breakfast under its covers. I've eaten, thanks, Jack said. Coffee, then? Jack considered the state of his nerves and his hangover. What the hell? Maybe he'd already blown it in the elevator. I don't suppose a Bloody Mary would be possible. Barnett didn't seem in the least surprised. I expect we can find one somewhere, he said. He turned to Fleur. Could you try and oblige Mr. Braun? Perhaps the press room downstairs would be the place to start. Certainly, Leo. Her tones were set at about 3 degrees Kelvin. Barnett smiled at her warmly. Thank you so much, Fleur. Jack's gaze bounced from Barnett to Fleur to Barnett again. Slut for the Lord, he thought again. And then, I wonder if his fiancée knows. Have a seat, Mr. Braun. Jack picked an armchair and settled into it. He reached into his pocket for a Camel. Barnett drew another armchair close to Jack's right side and sat in it, hunched forward slightly, his attitude expectant. How can I help you, Mr. Braun? Well, Jack took a deep breath and summoned what nerve he could. He tried to remember the acting lessons he'd taken 40 years before. See, Reverend, he said, I've almost died twice in the last couple days. I went off a balcony, and that was maybe enough to kill me if Hiram Worcester hadn't made me lighter than air. And last night, this ace called demise actually seemed to have stopped my heart for a while. His voice trailed off. The thing is, he said insistently, I wonder if somebody's trying to tell me something. Barnett gave a little wry smile, then nodded. You haven't had much occasion to give thought to the eternal, have you? No, I guess not. Life has always been right here on Earth for you. You've had eternal youth, an indestructible body. I assume you don't have to worry about money. He gave Jack a frankly admiring glance. I remember Tarzan very fondly, by the way. I don't think I ever missed an episode. I remember swinging from a rope down by the swimming hole back home, trying to give that yell you used to do. I never did the yell, actually, Jack said. It was dubbed in, a lot of different voices kind of strung together electronically. Barnett seemed a bit disappointed. Well, I guess you don't think about that when you're 10 years old. He grinned again. Whatever happened to the chimp, by the way? He's in the San Diego Zoo, which was the answer Jack always gave to that question, though it was completely untrue. Chester the chimp, shortly after entering adolescence, had been shot dead after trying to tear off his trainer's arm. Most people, Jack had learned, preferred the chimp to have a happy ending, an attitude Jack had no sympathy with, having himself always disliked the surly little scene-stealing beast. Barnett seemed to recollect himself. I'm sorry, Mr. Brown, he said. I'm afraid I've let myself distract you. That's okay. I'm not sure what I was going to say anyway. Many people don't have the terms for talking about the eternal. Barnett gave a quick, self-deprecating grin. Fortunately, we preachers are more or less equipped for the job. Yeah, well, that's why I'm here. Jack was having a hard time reconciling this laid-back Barnett with the ferocious preacher he'd seen in the videotapes. The blonde panther stalking his own congregation. The predator Jack was certain was a secret murderous ace. Could this be the same man? Jack cleared his throat. You ever seen picture of Dorian Gray? A great old Albert Lewin picture from the 40s. George Sanders, Herd Hatfield, Angela Lansbury. He cleared his throat again. The endotracheal tube had left it irritated, and his smoking wasn't helping it. Donna Reed, I think, he said, trying to remember. Yeah, Donna Reed. Anyway, it's about this young man who has his portrait painted, and his soul goes into the portrait. He starts living a real, I don't know, wicked life, whatever you want to call it, but he never has to face any of the consequences. He just stays young, and the portrait gets old, and dissipated. Is that the word? Barnett nodded. Anyway, at the end, the picture gets destroyed, and Dorian Gray gets all old and evil all at once and drops dead. He grinned. Special effects, you know. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot about that. I've been thinking, you know, I've stayed young for 40 years, and I haven't led a precisely unstained life. And what if it wears off? What if I get old all of a sudden, like Dorian Gray? Or what if some crazy ace kills me? Jack realized he was shouting. His heart lurched at the further realization that he wasn't acting anymore, that all this trauma was genuine. He cleared his throat again and settled into his seat. Barnett leaned toward Jack, put a hand on his arm. You'd be surprised how many visits I've had from people in your situation, Mr. Braun. Perhaps their presentiments were not as spectacular as yours, but I've seen a lot of people resembling you. Successful, outwardly contented men and women who gave no thought to the eternal until they were touched by it. Perhaps a warning heart attack. Perhaps a loved one killed in an accident or a parent suffering a fatal illness. He smiled. I don't believe any of these warnings are accidental, Mr. Braun. Jack. He stubbed out a cigarette. He'd almost lost it there, he thought. Jack, yes. I believe there is purpose to these warnings, Jack. I believe the Almighty has ways of reminding us of His existence. I believe that in these narrow escapes you've had, there is revelation of God's purpose. Jack looked through his dark shades into Barnett's twinkling blue eyes. Yeah, he said. There was a burning intensity in Barnett's china blue eyes. The Lord says, Look unto me, and be ye saved, all ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else. Look unto me, Jack thought. Did Barnett mean God, or himself? The preacher spoke on. Your wild card gave you a false belief in your own immortality, and the Lord has seen a way to warn you of its falsity, remind you whence true immortality lies, and spare you to do His work. There was a knock on the door. As the sound pulled him out of his track, Barnett seemed to jolt slightly. He looked at the door. Come in. Fleur entered with a Bloody Mary in a frigid hand. Mr. Braun's drink. Jack smiled at her. Call me Jack, please. She glared at him while Jack took the drink from her hand and looked into it under the rims of his shades to see if perhaps she'd spit in it. Thank you so much, Fleur. Barnett didn't smile quite as warmly this time. His words were a dismissal, and Fleur obeyed. Jack sipped his drink. It was excellent. Apparently someone in the press room knew how to keep the journalists happy. Is it good? Barnett seemed genuinely curious. It's fine. Jack took a bigger swallow. I've never... Barnett waved a hand. Well, that doesn't matter. Surprise rang through Jack at Barnett's wistful tone. Precisely that of a small boy whose mother won't let him outside to play in the rain. Maybe, Jack thought, Barnett really hadn't had any choice in his life. Maybe they'd all been made for him. Maybe the only time he ever did anything he wasn't supposed to was when he ran away to the Marine Corps. Hell, he thought savagely. Nobody makes you run for president. Barnett leaned back in his armchair, steepling his fingertips under his chin. His attention had returned fully to Jack. Jack looked at the preacher carefully from behind his big shades. I'd like to tell you about a dream of mine, Jack, Barnett said. His voice was soft, gentle. The Lord put it into my mind some years ago. In this dream, I found myself in a giant orchard. Everywhere I looked, there were fruit trees, all rich with God's abundance. There were all sorts of fruit in the orchard, Jack. Cherries and oranges and apples and persimmons and plums. Every conceivable variety, all filling God's vast cornucopia. The orchard was so beautiful that my heart just swelled up with joy and gladness. And then... Barnett looked up to the ceiling, as if he was seeing something there. Jack found his eyes following the preacher's, then caught himself. Stagecraft, he thought. He took a healthy swallow of his Bloody Mary. And then a cloud came over the sun, Barnett continued, and a dark rain began to fall from the cloud. The rain fell here and there in the orchard, and wherever it touched, the fruit was blighted. I could see all the oranges and lemons turning black and falling from the tree. I could see leaves withering and dying. And more than that, I could see the blight growing even after the rain passed. I could see the darkness reaching out to try to taint the healthy trees. And then I heard a voice. The preacher's voice changed, deepened, became stern. A chill surged up Jack's spine at the completeness of the transformation. I give this orchard into thy keeping. Unto thee I give the task of destroying this blight. Barnett's voice and manner changed again. He was fervent, exultant. His powerful voice rang in the small room. I knew the fruits of the orchard were God's children, made in his image. I knew the rain cloud was Satan. I knew the blight was the wild card, and I threw myself down on my face. Lord, I prayed, Lord, I am not strong enough. I am not worthy for this task. And the Lord said, I will give thee strength. Barnett was screaming now. I will make thy heart as steel. I will make thy tongue as sharp as a sword, and of thy breath a whirlwind. And I knew I had to do as the Lord asked of me. Barnett jumped out of his chair, paced back and forth as he talked, like God was jerking his chain, Jack thought. I knew I had the power to heal the wild card. I knew that the Lord's work had to be done, that his orchard had to be pruned. He waved a finger at Jack. Not as my critics would charge, he said. I would not prune wickedly, or arbitrarily, or maliciously. My critics say I want to put jokers in concentration camps. He gave a laugh. I want to put them in hospitals. I want to cure their affliction, and keep it from spreading to their children. I think it is sinful of the government to keep wild card research at such a low level of funding. I would multiply it tenfold. I would wipe this plague from the earth. Barnett turned to Jack. To Jack's amazement, there were tears in his eyes. You're old enough to remember when tuberculosis was a plague upon the land, Barnett said. You remember all the hundreds and thousands of tubercular sanatoriums that sprang up all over Arizona and New Mexico, where victims were kept from infecting others while science worked on a cure. That's what I want to do for the wild card. Jack, Barnett was pleading, the Lord has prolonged your life. The Lord has spared you from death. This can only be because he has a place for you in his plan. He wants you to lead the victims of this plague to their salvation. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. Healed, Jack. Barnett's face was joyful, rapturous. He stood in front of Jack, raised his hands triumphantly. Won't you help me, Jack? Help me bring the cure to God's afflicted. Pray with me now, Jack. Verily I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. But as many received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe in his name. Jack, to his astonishment, felt as if a giant hand gripped him by the neck and flung him out of his chair. Suddenly he was on his knees in front of the preacher, his two hands raised and clasped between the hands of the Reverend Leo Barnett. Tears streamed down Barnett's face as he lifted his head and cried out in prayer. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things become new. The man's power was almost palpable, Jack thought. This couldn't be all good showmanship and razzle-dazzle. Jack knew about showmanship. He'd never seen anything like this. He's an ace, Jack thought. My God, he really is an ace. Maybe he'd never really believed it till this minute. Barnett was an ace, and Jack was going to bring him down.
11 a.m. Cal Ridkin sounded like the acne-scarred junk food addict he was. In the background of all his conversations was the rustle of plastic wrappers. His words were slurred by the effort of sneaking around wads of Twinkies, Snickers, and Fritos. He sounded fat, slow, and lazy. Only the first of those was true. Greg had taken him as a puppet long ago, more from reflex than desire. He played with Redkin's voracious appetite, mildly amused that he could make a man eat until he was literally sickeningly stuffed. But that had not fed Puppet Man particularly well, and Greg had rarely utilized his link. Redkin was not Hiram, an ace with peculiar abilities and tastes. Redkin was a competent, if sedentary, investigator. There was no one better at following the confusing labyrinth of bureaucracy. It had been Redkin who put together overnight the unproved web of conjecture with which Greg had confronted Tachyon. Now he'd make sure the conjecture became fact. The phone rang twice at the other end, followed by an audible gulp, and, Redkin. Cal, Greg Hardman here.
Senator, cellophane tore in the background, a new snack being open. You got my package all right?
Early this morning, Cal, thanks.
No sweat, Senator. Interesting stuff you had me looking up, he added reflectively. He took a bite of something, chewing noisily.
That's what I want to talk with you about. We need to pursue this further. I need to know if we can bring charges against Tachyon.
Senator. Swallow. All we have now is circumstantial stuff. A Russian agent assigned to the right city in the right year, another coincidental crossing of paths in London last year, your contact in the JJS and her story, a few other tenuous links here and there, nothing solid. Not even close.
It scared hell out of him, Cal. I saw it. I know something's there.
That's still far from proving it.
Then it has to get closer. You know what video told us last year? Gimli and Kahina had definite Soviet connections. An agent met with them one night last year in New York, and Gimli called him Polyakov.
Polyakov's dead, Senator. All our sources say the same thing. The KGB and the GRU believe it, too. Maybe they're just using his name to confuse us.
They're all wrong. Video still has the pictures in her mind. He matches Polyakov's description.
So do a few thousand other people. There's a lot of fat, bald old men. Plus, you're not going to get any court to accept a Joker's wildcard talent as evidence. A metal projection isn't a photograph.
It's a start. Find her. Look at what she has. Listen to her. Then keep digging.
Redkin sighed. Plastic crackled like dry leaves, and his voice was suddenly muffled by something soft. Okay, Senator, I'll do it. I'll try. How soon do you need this?
A week ago. Yesterday at the latest. Another sigh.
Oh, I get the idea. I'll call New York as soon as I'm off.
Anything else? Soon, Cal. I gotta have this soon.
You're asking me to miss lunch? You do this for me, and I'll buy you your own damn restaurant. You got a deal, Senator. Talk to you later.
The last word was obscured as Redkin placed another bite of something in his mouth. The line clicked and went dead.
Somebody's on us. What? Tachyon slewed around in the cab and stared out the back window. Aykroyd laid a hand on his arm. Easy, he's good. You'll never spot him that way. Cabby? The detective fished out his wallet. There's an extra 50 in it for you if you can lose the gray Dodge. Back about 3 cars. The man's black face split in a wide grin. Sure thing, mister. Tachyon followed Jay's mortified gaze as the detective fanned out a 10 and 3 ones. Grumbling, Tachyon pulled out his wallet and stripped off the bills, tucked them into the driver's shirt pocket, and promptly landed in Aykroyd's lap as the cab accelerated abruptly into a hard left turn. Blaze, grinning delightedly, clung like a young monkey to the front seat. Just like Paris, quiche dad? Huh? Asked Jay. Never mind. You know enough of my secrets, growled Tachyon. Jay glanced behind. Still on us. Damn, he's good.
What are we going to do?
The fluttering in his stomach was back, and Tack could feel a fine shivering running through his hands. Aykroyd ran a hand across his mouth. There's probably not going to be time for any long goodbyes. The Motel 6 sign loomed ahead.
Sarah's there too, said Tachyon.
Jesus Christ, you got the whole New York Philharmonic there? Maybe the Dodgers?
This is no laughing matter.
No shit. Punch it, buddy. Everything she's got. The cab gunned down the street, turned with a squeal of tires into the parking lot. The threesome were out before the car had stopped rolling. Jay flung his remaining 10 over his shoulder as they pelted for the room. Sarah was curled up on the bed, legs tucked beneath her, pillow clutched to her chest, listening to the television. Polyakov, a bemused expression on his round face, stepped back to avoid being trampled. Jay seized the edge of the door and slammed it shut. Through the deadbolt, Tachyon ran to Sarah and yanked her up off the bed. Blaze flung himself into the Russian's arms.
No time to explain. Hartman knows. There is someone after us.
Tachyon seized Sarah's dress at the neck and pulled. It ripped with a loud rending sound. Sarah screamed and covered herself. She was wearing only her bra.
Into the shower, quick. Don't come out. And by the way, you rent by the hour.
The alien was propelling her towards the bathroom door, unsnapping her bra as they went. Heavy footfalls were coming down the hall at a run. Polyakov's gray eyes were calm, fatalistic.
There's no time. Yes, there is. Jay will get you out of Atlanta. For the God's sake, Blaze, move.
The water thundered on. Polyakov gently sat the boy aside.
Open up! Open the goddamn door!
Tachyon recognized Billy Ray's voice. Now, he hissed urgently to the detective. Aykroyd formed his fingers into a gun. Polyakov vanished. There was an audible pop as the air rushed back into the space formerly occupied by a body. Tachyon leaped across the room, seized the bottle of vodka on the dresser, ripped open his collar, and in a long, low dive threw himself onto the bed. The door blew open, splinters flying across the room as Billy Ray bulled through. Jay shielded Blaze with his body, and Tack covered his face. The Justice Department ace had a gun, a .44 Magnum. Tachyon stared down the barrel. It yawned like a cave's mouth.
All right, where is he? Where the fuck is he?
Huh? Asked Jay.
Asshole.
Ray stiff-armed the detective, and Aykroyd went down. Ray tore the closet door off its hinges and flung down the clothes, glanced beneath the bed, headed for the bathroom door. Tachyon crossed his fingers and prayed to whatever ancestors might be lurking nearby.
Get out of there, now!
Sarah's voice floated over the rush of falling water, clearly female, heavily southern. Tachyon prayed that he was the only one who heard the panic underlying the words.
Well, sugar, how many boys are there gonna be?
The shower curtain rasped back. Sarah screamed. For a long moment there was a silence from the bathroom, the sharp report of a slap. Ray re-entered the room, the pale pink imprint of a palm already fading from his cheek, the front of his white uniform wet from the thundering water. Breathing heavily, he said,
"He was here. The goddamn Russian was here."
Jay looked at Tack.
"Russian? I don't see any Russian. Do you see a Russian? And sweet cheeks in there sure don't sound Russian. Russian? Cost you extra."
He grinned at the outraged ace.
"Why did you try to get away from me?"
Tachyon sighed, took a long pull on the bottle.
"Because I was afraid you were the press, and I didn't want to be found visiting a prostitute."
"You always take a kid?"
He gestured at Blaze with the .44.
Could you put the gun away? It makes me nervous when you wave it around like that. Most fatal shootings are accidental, you know. Ray glared at him. This wouldn't be an accident. Answer the fucking question!
With a delicate clearing of the throat, Tachyon said, Well, that is the matter in a nutshell. It's time the boy learned.
He glanced about the motel room. This lacks the ambience that I could wish, but she is very good. I tried her myself last night. Of course, nothing can compare with the woman my father gave to me on my 14th birthday.
Ray stormed back through the shattered door.
14? No kidding. Oh, Ackroyd, please.
12 noon. You call the press conference, Jack told him. The press hasn't seen you for days. If I call them, they might not show up. Barnett had agreed. Jack watched the convention while the plans went forward. Hartman had clearly lost all momentum. Totals changed on every ballot. The only steady factor was Barnett's slow advance, gaining with every step as the opposition began to disintegrate. Rodriguez looked pole-axed every time he announced California's changing delegate count. Jack's heart went out to him. The press conference was arranged in one of the hotel's function spaces, the place Barnett used as a press office. Jack managed to down two more Bloody Marys before the business began. Fleur spoke first, standing behind a podium crowned with a forest of network microphones. Jack and Barnett stood off to one side as Fleur went through a long round of mic tests. She kept casting Jack sidelong glances throughout. Obviously, she didn't trust him an inch. Even hidden behind his Hollywood shades, Jack felt naked. Before the Reverend Barnett's announcement, Fleur said, there will be another brief announcement from someone who may be a surprise to you. I'm referring to Mr. Jack Braun, the head of Senator Hartman's California delegation, also known as Golden Boy. Jack didn't smile or wave as he stepped to the podium. Microphones jabbed at him like a forest of spears. He took off his shades, folded them, smiled into the blinding camera light. He hoped the booze and sleeplessness hadn't made his eyes too red. I've just finished a 2-hour interview with the Reverend Leo Barnett, Jack began. He could hear automatic cameras making zipping noises as they fired at him. He gripped the podium and tried not to feel the earthquake that rocked his nerves. This convention has seen a lot of strange events, a lot of violence, he said. Some people have been killed. Two attempts have been made on Senator Hartman's life, both by wild card aces, and I have fought both those aces personally. The Reverend Barnett has claimed all along that wild cards have been responsible for much of the chaos that has plagued this campaign. After the meeting today, I can only agree with him. Jack's 40-year-old media reflexes told him that the TV camera's long lenses were zooming in. Except for the sound of automatic cameras and snapping shutters, the room was absolutely quiet. Jack screwed his face into an expression of deep sincerity and gazed steadily out into the audience, just like when, years ago, he'd played Eddie Rickenbacker telling General Pershing he wanted to fly. There are secret aces at this convention, Jack said. There is one in particular who has a very influential role. He's responsible for a lot of the chaos here, for at least some of the deaths. I believe he can influence people at a distance to cause them to act in ways contrary to the law and their own interests. Other aces, murderous aces, work for him. They have tried to destroy his opponents by violence. Jack could sense Barnett and Fleur standing to one side, their heads together as they tried to figure out where he was taking this. Jack gave the cameras a grim Clint Eastwood smile. After my interview this morning, I've concluded that that secret ace, insert dramatic pause here, he thought, is the Reverend Leo Barnett. Cameras began swinging crazily, trying to get Barnett's reaction. Jack raised his voice and shouted into the mic stand. Barnett's behind the assassination attempts, he said, triumph sang in his veins. I defy Leo Barnett to prove he isn't an ace. Barnett gaped at him. Fleur Van Rensselaer's face was dead white, her mouth moving in furious, silent anger. Barnett shook his head slowly, as if shaking off a punch, then stepped forward. Though he never intended to, Jack found himself backpedaling, surrendering the podium. The preacher leaned over the microphones, hands in his pockets, and gave a shaky grin. I don't know what Jack's up to here, he said. I came down for another reason entirely. But if it's what Jack wants, I'm willing to stand right here for however many hours it takes to assemble a team of doctors to give me the blood test. His grin widened. I know I don't have the wild card, and anyone who says I do is a liar, or... He cast a sidelong glance at Jack, deeply misguided. Jack stared back into the preacher's blue eyes and felt his triumph drain into his black Italian wingtips. Somehow, he thought, he'd fucked up again.
Spectre turned on the tap over the bathroom sink and took a mouthful of water. He swished it around for a few moments and spat it out. The water was stained brown from the dried blood. Spectre took another mouthful and swallowed it. He was as thirsty as he was tired. He was always this way when he had to heal up after a major injury. He tested his jaw. It moved up and down without too much trouble, but side to side hurt like hell. He could feel the bone popping in its socket. After a few months, it might not be so bad. All in all, things could be much worse. He heard a sound at the door. Spectre knew he didn't have time to get back under the bed. He looked around the bathroom. The only place big enough was the shower. He stepped inside just as the door to his room shut. Somebody was talking softly to himself in the bedroom, and Spectre had an idea who it was. When the noises approached the bathroom, Spectre held his breath. Again. Much more of this, and he turned blue permanently. He focused the death pain. It was always there, always ready. He saw pudgy fingers on the edge of the shower curtain. The man tore the plastic curtain back and opened his mouth to scream. Spectre locked eyes before the desk clerk could get anything out. He pushed him to the point of death, then stopped. Spectre caught him by the collar as he slumped over. He leaned the man against the bathroom wall and emptied his victim's pockets. He took the keys and wallet and ignored the rest. The guy probably knew just about everything there was to know about the hotel. If Spectre could get him to tell the truth, he might find out a few things. Spectre bent down. He steadied the man with one hand and slapped him with the other. When he started to come around, when Spectre was sure he could feel it, he popped the guy really hard a few times. The man opened his eyes. Spectre put a hand over the pudgy mouth. Quiet. If you call for help, if you answer my questions in anything but a whisper, if you don't answer my questions, I'll kill you. You understand? The man nodded. Spectre slowly took his hand away. Who are you?
My name's... He took a breath. Hastings.
Spectre checked the wallet. So far, so good. What are you doing in here? Hastings stared wide-eyed around the room. He seemed to be looking through Spectre for a way out.
The government people told us to be on the lookout for anyone we thought was suspicious. I just had a feeling about you.
I don't much appreciate that. He checked the first name on the driver's license. Maurice.
Hastings wiped his mouth. You're not who you say you are. Not Baird. You're an ace.
Spectre nodded. You know, with your deductive skills and your gift for hunches, you'd make a damn good PI.
The man gave a half smile, trying to acknowledge the compliment in spite of his fear. Thanks.
Spectre waited a few moments and then added, I hate PIs. He was enjoying the hell out of this. He'd almost forgotten about this jerk-off, and now he had the fat bastard on a horn.
Oh, God, please, don't kill me. I'll do anything.
Hastings was shaking. He wiped his mouth again. Oh, I'm not going to kill you. Not if you give me what I want. Spectre lied, trying to think of the best place to hide the body. We'll start with an easy question. Where's the nearest unoccupied room on this floor?
We're full up, I swear.
Spectre clucked his tongue. Don't bullshit me. I know there's always a few left vacant for contingencies. You know what I'm going to do if you keep lying to me? I can make you do an airwalk from the 10th floor down to the lobby. The fall will only take a few seconds. Make quite a mess, though. Maybe I should just put you in the shower and liquefy you. Down the drain you go. No muss, no fuss.
No, please.
Hastings clasped his hands together.
I think 1019 is open. Just don't kill me. I'm sorry I bothered you. I can do whatever you need. Give the Secret Service some bad leads. Really.
Spectre pulled a card out of Hastings' wallet. This is your passkey?
He chewed his lip for a second before replying, yes.
Spectre leaned in close to Hastings and stared into his eyes. You're not lying to me now.
No. May God strike me. It's the truth, I swear.
Right. Get into the shower. Spectre pulled back the curtain. Do it now. Hastings hustled his overweight body inside.
But why?
Spectre locked eyes again and made it count this time. Hastings collapsed onto the tile. His body twitched and then was still. That's why. He slowly closed the curtain. Nobody fucks with me and gets away with it. It wasn't the best place to put a corpse, but as usual, he'd had to improvise. Spectre checked himself in the mirror one more time. Now he had a crooked jaw to match his crooked smile. Maybe when it was all over, he could buy a crooked house in the Bahamas. But not until Hartman was done with. Then he could worry about vacation time.
1 p.m. You weenie! There was a furious glare from Tachyon's violet eyes as he stalked by, medical bag in hand. Behind him, reporters were clustered three deep around Barnett, who had, of course, passed the blood test without registering the taint of any black rain from Satan. Oh, shut up, mumbled Jack from deep in the heart of another Bloody Mary. Tachyon spun on his heel, marched back, stood in front of Jack, his pointed chin thrust out. You may have just given the nomination to Barnett. You realize that. I thought that was you, Jack's formless anger centered on Tachyon. I thought that was you off banging Floor and switching to Jackson when things got tough. Tachyon colored. The only thing you can do now is to try to move California to Jackson. Jack sneered at him. Fuck you, asshole. At least I'm doing something. Tachyon stared at him, swallowed a retort or two, then flounced away. Jack, standing by himself at the back of the press room, realized he was going to be mobbed by reporters as soon as Barnett finished his speech. He headed back to the bar, set up in the back of the room, found a 500-milliliter flask of 151-proof rum, and put it in his pocket. He figured he'd probably be safest on the convention floor, where he could hide behind the rest of his delegation.
2 p.m. Greg phoned from Ellen's hospital room. He stroked her hair as the call went through, smiling at her pale, drawn face. Ellen tried to smile back and failed. She looked lovely and very vulnerable, and he could feel tears starting in his eyes, looking at her. God, I'm sorry, Ellen. I'm very, very sorry. Someone picked up the phone, and he tore his attention away from her. Cal? Hartman? Senator? Redkin sounded nervous. Greg could tell that he didn't want to talk. How's things going?
The fat SOB. If we were there, Puppet Man rose angry.
That's what I wanted to know. I'd expected some action by now, Cal. That put the man immediately on the defensive. Greg could damn near see the flush on Redkin's pimply face as he blustered. He'd be reaching for a candy bar in consternation. Look, Senator, it isn't so easy, the rapper snapped in the background.
The bottom line on your Russian is that he's dead. Dead a year and a half and fried to a crisp. The file is closed according to everyone I've talked to, and no one in the Justice Department, the CIA, or the FBI seems inclined to open it. I'm getting tired of being told I'm nuts or a pain in the ass or stupid.
Greg could feel his own temper fraying. Redkin was stonewalling and making excuses, and in the meantime, Tachyon was still here and still kissing up to Jackson. Devon was scowling and cursing, and all the political favors had been called in just to slow the reverse momentum. Ellen smiled at Greg quizzically from her bed, sleepy from a shot of Demerol. Greg brushed her hair back from her forehead and shrugged back to her. He took a deep breath and returned his attention to the phone.
Video's got the damn pictures, Cal. I know she's a joker, but the images are real. Didn't they convince someone to at least start looking? Didn't you get her deposition? What about the reporter who made Polyakov here in Atlanta? Doesn't anyone believe him?
No one can find video, Senator. That's the problem. A reporter's supposed sighting isn't enough. No one's seen video for several days. Without her, well, I don't know how much I can help you.
That's not good enough, Greg said flatly. Not good enough at all.
Cal sighed, just on the verge of insolence. He put something in his mouth, chewed noisily. Puppet Man stirred.
When we get back to Washington, he'll pay for this.
Greg pushed the power back down, harshly.
I'm sorry, Senator, Redkin was saying again. I've done all I can do at the moment. We'll keep looking for video. I'll keep following the paper trail, but it's damn cold, and you know how slow that can be at the best of times. I'll hound Peters over at Intelligence and tell him again that his dad is screwy. If I do get more, I'll make sure the right people jump, but it might be a few days before that happens.
Greg's temper went entirely.
I don't have a goddamn few days, Cal. I may not even have this afternoon.
There was no answer to that, just the hiss of the satellite connection and Redkin's chewing.
Look, get what you can as soon as you can, Greg said at last, and keep in mind that I'll remember just how well you do.
He slammed the phone back into the cradle.
Serious problems?
Ellen asked. She held out her hand to Greg. He took it. He let Puppet Man lick at the pain that leaked around the edges of the Demerol. It seemed to salve his own frustration.
We have to do it ourselves, Greg. There's no other way. It's safe now with Gimli taken care of. Think of it.
Greg was, and he knew exactly what he needed to do. Maybe, he said in answer to Ellen's question. Or maybe not as serious as I'd thought. There's other ways to deal with the problem. It's time to start using them.
I'm sorry you and Dr. Tachyon quarreled, Greg. He's such a nice man, but so stubborn.
Don't worry about it, darling, he said. Tachyon is just a temporary problem.
4 p.m. It was like being on Mercury. The air conditioning of the Marriott beat on his back as he stepped through the doors. The Atlanta heat started the sweat rolling down his face. The sidewalk was crowded with Jackson supporters waving bright red Jesse signs. Just beyond them was the limo. Jackson clasped Tachyon's hand and lifted them up over their heads. Tachyon squirmed, dancing on his toes. The Reverend was so much taller. A ragged cheer went up, and they headed for the limo, smiling and shaking hands as the spectators crowded in around them. Jackson pressed the flesh with practiced ease. Tachyon looked at him enviously. Aykroyd was waiting at the door of the car. What now?
Jesse wants us to talk to the Jokers outside the Omni, Tachyon explained. He and I together. His positions on wild card issues are just as strong as Hartman's. If they will only listen. He gave a long, deep sigh. Jay, if you have other leads to follow up, there's really no need for you to come along.
Jay shrugged. Might as well, he said. Can't dance. At least the limo was air-conditioned, Tachyon thought gratefully, as they drove off. Jackson's bodyguard, the ace called Straight Arrow, stared implacably across at him. Tach began to realize how hopeless, how stupid this was. They were not going to listen.
Jesse would have a better chance without him. Tension made his voice jump as he blurted, "This is not going to work."
"Faith, Doctor," said Jackson.
He was wedged firmly between Jay Aykroyd and the Reverend. He looked desperately from Jay to Jesse.
"They hate me now."
The limo pulled up, and Jackson studied the ranks of silent jokers.
"Only some. It's not as if you switched your support to Barnett. I'm not that unacceptable, am I?"
"Not to me." Tack gave the tall human's arm a squeeze.
"And you will convince them, I know it."
"Well, help me a little."
"I will do my uttermost best."
Straight Arrow swung open the door of the black limousine, and Jackson and Tachyon stepped back out into the heat. The police had driven a wedge into the jokers. At the end of that long aisle was a flatbed truck equipped with a sound system. The heat was unbelievable, bouncing in waves off the pavement. As he watched, Tack saw Arachne's 8 legs fold beneath her, and she went down with a sigh. There was a flurry of movement as her gnat daughter dropped down to her mother's side and began fanning the unconscious woman with a folded newspaper.
"How can they hate them so?"
Tachyon asked. The lilac eyes were wide with misery.
"They're pitiful and so brave, so very brave."
The crowd had noticed them. Uncertainty ran like a shiver through them. Then large numbers began pushing forward against the lines of police as Jackson walked into their midst. Setting his jaw, Tachyon threw back his head and followed. His eyes met Gills's. The joker's thick neck worked, the membranes over the gills fluttering. He hacked, and a gob of thick white mucus hit Tachyon in the face. The alien recoiled, then lunged forward, hand outstretched, pleading for understanding. But Gills had already turned his back on Tachyon. He mopped away the spittle, and they moved deeper into the crowd. Up ahead, Tack could hear the ring of Jesse's voice, but the words eluded him. He was too busy scanning the crowd, evaluating the faces of his friends and people. Disinterest, outright hatred, sympathy. A shadow fell across him. Turtle. But Tommy flew on. A huge pallid figure snapped the linked arms of two policemen. A brick wall wasn't going to stop 600 pounds of doughboy. He rolled to a stop before the tiny alien.
"Doctor?"
"Yes, dear." He couldn't bring himself to call the joker doughboy.
"They said Miss Sarah's a traitor, and now they say that you are too. I don't understand."
"It's very confusing, child."
"Don't you love the senator anymore?"
Tack covered his eyes with a hand. "I love all of you better."
"Funny way of showing it,"
howled a voice from the crowd.
"Traitor! Traitor! Traitor!"
The sound battered at him, and Tack dropped his face into his hands. Suddenly Jackson was there, an arm tight about his shoulders.
"Come on, you can do it. We walk through this crowd, we get up on that truck, and we speak. It's going to be all right."
"No, Reverend. I am afraid that some things can never be repaired." But he had been reminded of his duty, so with a smile firmly in place, Tack began moving down the line of people. Some of the most unbelievable things were held out to him. Claws, tentacles, misshapen lumps covered with foul-smelling discharge. The sight of a normal human hand was such a relief that Tachyon almost ran to grip it. A young man dressed in a leather jacket, despite the heat, raised heavy lids to regard him, eyes as blank as a shark's.
Joker has clogged the street, silent and horrible. The heat and the light seem to suffocate you, to wrap around your chest like a python, tightening by degrees. It reminded Mackie of Hamburg in summertime. He hated anything that reminded him of home. He hated the heat and the humidity, and wasn't too crazy about the light of day. Most of all, he hated jokers. Nonetheless, he was happy. Redemption sang in his veins, like a hit of good speed. Der Mann, was giving him another chance. He was Mac Heath again, slipping through the mob with his song bubbling Montrick down in his throat. In this mass of monsters, nothing was remarkable, particularly Mackie. His lack of size let him avoid most contact. The awful heat sent sweat tentacles crawling down his ribs inside his jacket and aging t-shirt. But his personal stink was lost in the crowd. Glancing impact, then, "Hey there, motherfucker!" The hand on his arm was feathered. "Watch who you're shoving! Who the fuck do you think you are?" "I make the knife, you filthy creature!" Anger swelled like his cock. He started to bring a buzz. "No. Remember your job." He snarled something wordless and phased out, leaving the monstrosity standing there holding air. The stupid look on what passed for its face made him laugh. Insubstantial, he walked through a maggot clump of horrors pretending to be people, found an eddy big enough to phase his skinny body back in. The jokers paid him no mind. A chant had started, low and hostile. The words blurred in his mind. He didn't try to understand. Jokers had nothing to say. The beasts didn't even know he was walking through them. He was Mackie Messer. He was stone mystery and death. He was invincible. Looming alongside his quarry was the tall nigger running for president. And wasn't that capitalist decadence, to let such people hold political office? Karl Marx said the black man was a slave, and Der Alte Karl knew what he was talking about. The man hanging tight on Tack's other side struck Mackie somehow familiar, probably one of the aliens' toadies from Jokertown. Tachyon was moving down a line, shaking hands or whatever. The thought of all that Joker touch made Mackie's skin creep. He circled, like the shark in his song, who wears his teeth in his face. "You must be extremely careful," the man had said. "Tachyon is a mind reader. You must not let him sense your intention." Good enough. He was Mac the Knife. He knew how to do these things. It would be simple to phase through the crowd, approach from behind, buzz his hand, and jam it right through Dr. Precious Tachyon's alien fucking heart. It would be too simple. He'd never done an alien before, nor had he done anybody really big, really famous like Tachyon was. He wanted to feel Tachyon's eyes in his. He wanted the little bastard to know who was killing him. The jokers surged forward, carrying him right where he needed to go. The world contracted to Tachyon, and the touch.
The afternoon came to Jack in little coherent bursts, interspersed with noise and pointless movement, like a film cut into pieces and spliced together at random. Delegates surged back and forth, vote totals changed by the half hour. The only two constants were that Hartman was losing votes and Barnett was gaining. Despite denials from Hartman and Devon, everyone assumed that Jack's accusation of Barnett had been a last, desperate attempt by Hartman's camp to regain its lost momentum. "Hey," Devon finally scowled as reporters pressed him. "Give the guy a break. Yesterday somebody stopped his heart. Who knows how many brain cells he lost?" "Thanks, Charles," Jack thought, compassionate, as always. The only conceivable remedy was another swig of overproof. Jim Wright, calling for vote after vote, looked as if his liver had just failed. Fistfights swirled on the floor. The band played whatever came into its collective head, anything from Stephen Foster to Jagger Richards. A Starshine glider crashed in front of Jack, and he stepped on it by mistake while trying to pick it up. He tried to throw the crumpled thing anyway, and it came apart as it left his hand. Fucking flying Joker, he thought. As Jack finished the bottle, a kind of lucidity returned, an intense consciousness of the horror of it all. Ah, shit, Jack thought. I've drunk myself sober. No choice, he decided, but to get another bottle. He lurched from his seat and headed across the pandemonium toward the nearest exit. As he left the auditorium, he saw a young woman with Hartman buttons talking earnestly to a tall black man in horn rims. Sorry, Sheila, the man in glasses said. Your old man's the nicest guy I've ever met, and I'm sorry to disappoint him, but if I don't switch to Jesse on this vote, I can kiss my standing in the neighborhood goodbye. Some kind of rally was going on right outside the auditorium. There was a flatbed truck covered with Jackson banners and a limo trying to get through the crowd toward it, the horn bleeding. Swarming around everything were more Jokers than Jack had ever seen in one place. He tried moving through the crowd, but it was too dense. The people in the limo must have decided the same thing, because its doors opened and the passengers got out. Straight Arrow in his gray uniform. Some little white guy Jack didn't recognize, Jesse Jackson, and Tachyon. Great. Just the people Jack wanted to see. The crowd roared. Media people jostled Jokers to find camera setups. Police and Secret Service were trying to wedge their way to the truck without knocking anyone off their feet. Tachyon and the candidate were shaking hands as they progressed. Someone spit in Tack's face. Straight Arrow looked appalled. Probably not at the saliva, but at the fact it could as easily have been a bullet. A shadow passed overhead and Jack looked up. The turtle moved past in silence. Someone had painted Hartman across his shell in big silver letters. Jack looked down and saw, through a split-second gap in the crowd, the freak gliding through the crowd. The kid with buzzsaw hands, just 15 feet away. Adrenaline crashed into Jack with the force of a hurricane. No! He yelled, and began to swim through the crowd with great sweeps of his arms, driving his way heedless of yells of protest. The leather boy had disappeared. Jack craned to find him. Then there he was, leaning forward under the arm of a policeman, his hand outstretched. Tachyon saw him and smiled. No! Jack yelled again, but no one could hear him. Tachyon took the hand.
Tachyon took his hand with something like relief. He clamped down hard. I'm Mackey Missa, he said, and laid on maximum buzz.
There was a shower of blood and bone and the buzzsaw sound that Jack remembered all too well. Tachyon screamed. So did 100 other people. So, maybe, did Jack. Jack charged forward, but the crowd was surging back, and he stumbled, almost fell, as people went down around him. A silver-eyed Joker child was clutching his leg. Jack tried to shake the boy off, yelling in fury. Tachyon staggered back, blood pulsing from his torn wrist. Straight Arrow had been watching the crowd around Jackson and was only now turning his head to comprehend the situation. The policeman, under whose arm the leather boy had reached, was the only one near enough to react. Half the cop's face was dripping with Tachyon's blood, and his actions were slowed by shock. He tried to grab the boy's leather jacket. If he'd had time to think, he'd have done almost anything but that. The leather boy turned to face the cop, and Jack's heart jumped into his throat. All the kid had to do was glance past the policeman and see Jack heading for him. But the freak didn't notice Jack. He was too busy smiling up at the cop, his tongue enjoying the taste of Tachyon blood on his lower lip. He sliced off the cop's right arm at the shoulder. The kid turned back to Tachyon, away from Jack. Jack shook off the Joker kid and ran, his arm cocking back, his hand making a fist. If the kid was going to finish off Tack, he'd have to remain material, and Jack could hit him with all the force of a cannon. The leather boy reached toward Tachyon. His hand movement was gentle, almost a caress. One more step, and Jack was going to knock the hunchback's head about 20 blocks. Jack let the punch go, and the freak disappeared with a pop. The punch spun him around as Jack screamed in rage. Tachyon's blood slipped under his feet, but somehow he managed to stay upright. Who did that? He shrieked. Straight Arrow was standing there, a flaming arrow raised high in one hand, like a statue of Zeus throwing a thunderbolt. The Secret Service had knocked Jackson down and had piled on him. A lot of guns were out. Aykroyd, Straight Arrow said. The flame disappeared from his fingertips. The crowd moaned as if in pain. Men with television cameras circled the police cordon, trying to get a better look. The eyes of the nation were sopping it all up. Tachyon's eyes fluttered, and he fell to the pavement. The cop was screaming. Jack could see that his wound was too high to tourniquet. Jack stepped up to him, drew back his fist, hit him gently on the temple. The policeman's head bounced like a punching bag, and he went unconscious. Straight Arrow stepped next to Jack. His shocked face was pale. He reached out a hand to the policeman's wounded shoulder. Flame pulsed hotly. Blood hissed, boiling away, as he cauterized the wound. The smell of burning flesh eddied up, and from Jack's layered memories came the screams of a man burning to death in a flaming tank somewhere under Casino. Maybe the cop's life could be saved, if the man didn't die of shock in the next 5 minutes. Jack followed, feeling helpless, as Straight Arrow moved to Tachyon's side and picked up the wounded arm. Tachyon's face and ruffles were covered with blood. There were things grinding under Jack's feet that he didn't want to think about. Straight Arrow cauterized Tack's wound with the same efficient pulse of flame he'd used on the cop. Jack turned away, not wanting to have to listen to the hiss of blood, smell the burning meat. He reached for his cigarettes. Rage danced through his nerves. He'd had the kid. Would have crushed his murderous little head like an eggshell. Jesse Jackson was getting to his feet. From his bewildered expression, it was clear he hadn't seen a thing. Secret Service were trying to call for ambulances on their radios. Aykroyd. Straight Arrow rose from his crouch. Where did you send him? Aykroyd was the nondescript-looking man Jack had seen leave the limousine with Tack and Jackson. He seemed as much in shock as anyone else. Yeah, he said. Oh, Jesus. His hands wandered over his own body, as if he had an itch he couldn't locate. You, Jack roared. Who the hell are you? Aykroyd looked at him uncomprehendingly. Jay Aykroyd, Straight Arrow said. Private cop. They call him Poppin' Jay. I had the bastard. Jack shook his fist in rage, crushing his pack of cigarettes. I could have turned him into jello. Ah, fuck. He threw down the pack of cigarettes and kicked it into the crowd. Where'd you send him, Aykroyd? Popped him, Aykroyd said. Straight Arrow grabbed him by the lapels and shook him. Where'd you send the assassin? Oh, Aykroyd licked his lips. New York, the Tombs. Straight Arrow took his hands off the detective and straightened in satisfaction. Good, he said. Jack wanted to knock Aykroyd into the next country. He walks through walls, he yelled. He's out by now. Straight Arrow's face fell. Ambulance sirens wailed in the distance. Jack looked around the scene, the two wounded men. Jackson kneeling by Tachyon, the Secret Service with their guns out, the crowd wailing and moaning in shock, TV cameras taking it all in. He'd lost again, Jack realized. Another tragedy he couldn't stop. Everything was slipping through his fingers. And no one was going to profit from any of this, besides Leo Barnett.
He was in a room surrounded by big niggers and bars. For a moment, Mackie thought he was dreaming. Then he became aware of the hot gobbets of alien meat clinging like melted plastic to his face and the front of his jacket. His right hand held air. His left was stiffened into a blade, vibrating, ready to take Dr. Tachyon's head off his shoulder. But he was no longer in the brightness of the Atlanta street, and there was no Tachyon. Nine! He screamed, slamming the heels of his hands against his forehead. Nine! 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 He had failed again. It wasn't possible. But he had failed. A hand clamped his shoulder. Nausea tsunami crashed from one side of his stomach to the other, as he turned to find himself staring up at a gigantic black with a hairless dome of head and a gold ring in his ear. Hey, man, the giant said in a mild voice. How the fuck you get in here? Mackie screamed again, this time making no attempt at words. He made his hands do things then. And then it was other people who were screaming. And when the screaming stopped, he ran straight through the bars of the holding cell, down green echoing corridors that reeked of puke and sweat and fear, and downstairs and out into the grimy sunlight of New York, He had to get back to Atlanta at once, to redeem himself in the eyes of his master, his love.
5 p.m. The first thing Greg did was shake Jesse's hand. Puppet Man raced outward from the touch, opening the man's mind eagerly. It was an exquisite mind, one that felt things deeply. That was, after all, the best kind. There was a wash of deep orange red there now, a memory of something very painful and horrible. Greg knew what that would be. Jackson hadn't changed his jacket. It was still spattered from Tachyon's blood. The sight of it made Greg uneasy, a fluttering of guilt returning that made Puppet Man mock him inside. Reverend, thank you for meeting me on such short notice and after such a horrible afternoon. How is Dr. Tachyon? Clinging to life. In critical condition. The doctors say there was too much damage to reattach the hand. Jackson's long, dark face frowned. A terrible event, Senator. A very terrible event. I have not seen such cold, sick violence since the Reverend King was assassinated. Puppet Man watched Jackson's emotions carefully. There was horror and fear and revulsion, but none of it was directed toward Greg, which told him that Tachyon was still remaining silent about Puppet Man. Good. Then it doesn't matter yet that Mackie didn't finish the job. There was only a faint yellow ochre of distaste inside Jackson directed at Greg, and Puppet Man easily pushed that back down, scrubbing it with the respect he knew Jackson had for Greg's stand on common issues. I'm sorry to hear that, Reverend, he said. Please, take a seat. I've told my aide to contact your staff and have a change of clothes sent over. Would you like anything to drink? Jackson declined with a wave of his hand and took a chair. Greg sat on the couch opposite him. He steepled his hands in front of his face as if trying to decide what to say. This isn't a time I'd choose to say any of this, Greg said at last. Not after this afternoon. But maybe this is the best time. We need to end the violence here. We need to unify the convention and start to work on the real campaign against Bush. I know what you're going to say, Senator. You should know that my staff wants me to say no. Jackson seemed easy and comfortable despite the trauma of the afternoon. He sat cross-legged, his big hands cupped around a knee. The dark stains on his jacket made the image eerily surreal. Outwardly, he was cool, collected, almost indifferent. Puppet Man knew better. Inside, the man was suddenly eager. He could see it, bright electric blue, flashing like lightning. They want me to say no, because they're convinced that with Dr. Tachyon's support, our Rainbow Coalition stands to win here. He continued. No half victories, Senator, but everything. I've had a friendship of nearly 20 years standing with Dr. Tachyon, Greg said. He's a prideful and very stubborn man. The truth is that you and I are only taking votes away from each other and allowing Barnett to win. The truth is that if the presidential candidate isn't me, it also won't be you. I think we both know that, no matter what we'd like to believe. If I don't win here, Leo Barnett will be the candidate. The attack on Tachyon today has only strengthened his position. Puppet Man could feel Jackson's irritation with that. It was no secret that the two ministers didn't care for each other. Jackson was an idealist, on the far left fringes of the party as Barnett was to the right. Greg let Puppet Man caress that irritation until Jackson visibly scowled. Reverend, you don't know why Tachyon came to you. Greg went on. My staff wanted to release this to the press after Tachyon withdrew his support, but I didn't let them, in deference to those 20 years of friendship. There's no graceful way to put this. In the last few days, the doctor has become involved in a relationship with Barnett's campaign manager, Fleur Van Rensselaer. I don't know whether she seduced him or he her. It doesn't matter, I suppose. But when I confronted him with it, he exploded. Said the relationship was none of my business. I insisted that indeed it was, understandably, I think, and pressed harder. Greg made a sour, chagrined face. I probably said some things I shouldn't have said. Our argument was bitter and harsh. He walked out. The next I heard of him, he was making the announcement that he was withdrawing his support. Greg smiled sadly. I can understand why he would turn to you, Reverend. We have our differences, but I think someone looking at our records and our public stance would find us very similar. We're both against prejudice and hatred of any kind. We'd both like to see all sides coming together to work in harmony. We've worked together on the platform fight. I know our ideals are the same. In Jackson's mind, Puppet Man pushed here, pulled there. That sounds like one of your campaign speeches, Senator. There was a faint smile on his face. I've heard the rhetoric before. And rhetoric is cheap, I know. I also know that if you look at my voting record, if you look at what I've done as chairman of SCARE, at how I've reacted to any Joker or civil rights legislation, then you'll see that we're not very far apart. I think we could work together well. Which brings us back to that question you haven't asked me yet, Senator. He's very interested, even without me. Feel it? Taste it? You know what I'm offering. Greg said it as a fact, not a question. You're offering the vice presidency, Jackson said, nodding. You're saying, Reverend Jackson, why don't you tell your delegates to vote for the Hartman-Jackson ticket? With my delegates and yours, we might win the nomination. With your voice, with your strength, with your power, we, Greg paused, stressing the word, we win, not just the nomination. We win the presidency. Desire was bright, bright blue. Modeling it underneath were dark splotches of doubt. Puppet Man scraped the darkness away and made them fade into nothingness. Jesse pursed his lips. I could make the same offer to you, Senator, he began, but Puppet Man was still prodding, still working on his mind. Jackson's voice faded. He nodded, held out his hand. All right, Senator, he said as they shook. You're right. It's time to build a bridge we can walk over. It's time to begin to bring all of us together. Puppet Man shouted in triumph. Greg laughed helplessly. He had it. This time he would have it. A little maneuvering yet to do, and it would be his.
The overproof rum hit Jack's stomach like a wave of welcome flame. He took another couple swallows, then capped the bottle and stuffed it in a pocket. He'd bought it after Tachyon had been carried off to the hospital, and the Secret Service let him go. There was still blood on his cuffs and shoes. He was trying not to think about how it got there, and he figured the overproof would help. He stepped up to one of the back doors of the Omni. Ah, hell, he thought. There was the big guard with the broken nose, Connolly. Connolly was already shaking his head, refusing admittance to a gray-haired man who was waving a pass in his face. Jack could almost recite the dialogue along with Connolly and the delegate. Sorry, nobody gets in this way. But I just left through this door. You saw me. Nobody gets in this way. Officer, I'm merely going to collect my daughter, who is a delegate. I do have a pass. A chill finger caressed Jack's neck at the sound of the man's voice. He stopped, about 10 feet behind the man, and stared at the back of his gray head. Where had he heard this before? Well, Connolly said slowly, I suppose it won't make that much difference, even though nobody's supposed to come through here. It'll be okay, said the man. Shaking his head as if he didn't realize why he was doing this, Connolly reached for his belt, produced a bunch of keys on a chain, and opened the door. Surprise danced through Jack's head. Thank you, officer. That's very kind. The man stepped through the door. Jack moved forward. Something here wasn't right. Excuse me, he said. Connolly glared at him. Where do you think you're going, asshole? Jack forced a smile. I'm a delegate. Connolly closed the door and firmly locked it. Nobody gets through this door. That's my instructions. Jack peered through the glass door at the gray-headed man's retreating form. You just let him through, he said. Connolly shrugged. What if I did? He's not even a delegate. I'm a delegate. Connolly looked at him. He's not an asshole. You are. As Jack stared through the glass door, he saw the gray-haired man glance back, A short take over his shoulder, his hand raised to give Connolly a friendly wave. The man saw Jack, and the bearded face turned to stone before the man dropped his arm and headed on his way. Jack's hackles rose. He'd seen that face recently, on the cover of Time magazine after an actor named Josh Davidson had done King Lear in Central Park. More importantly, he'd seen that look before. He remembered a bunch of dock workers dancing on a table, singing rum and Coca-Cola. "Sorry, Sheila," he remembered. "Your old man's the nicest guy I've ever met." He knew Davidson's look, Jack thought again. He'd seen it once before, back in 50, when he'd walked out of the committee room after testifying before HUAC, and walked right past where Earl and David and Blythe and Mr. Holmes were waiting, walked right past them without saying a word. Suddenly Jack was running, dashing past the surprised Connolly toward one of the doors he could use. Josh Davidson, Jack knew, was a secret ace. As Jack ran for the doors, the bottle of overproof slipped out of his pocket and smashed on the concrete. He didn't slow down. So far as anyone knew, Jack was the only one of the four aces left alive. No one knew for sure, because one of the four was missing. After serving 3 years on the island of Alcatraz for contempt of Congress, David Harstein had walked off the boat in 1953. A year later, Congress passed the Special Conscription Act, and Harstein had been drafted. He never reported. No one had seen him since. There were rumors that he'd died, been murdered, defected to Moscow, changed his name, and moved to Israel. There hadn't been a single rumor to the effect that he'd had some plastic surgery, done a little weightlifting, put on some weight, grown a beard, taken voice lessons, and become a Broadway actor. "Your old man's the nicest guy I've ever met." Naturally. No one could dislike David Harstein. Not once his pheromones got to them. No one could disagree with him. No one could avoid doing what he wanted them to do. Jack waved his ID at the man at the door, then plunged through. He ran through the crowd of people in the direction he'd last seen Davidson, ignoring the stares of the other delegates. Over the heads of others, he saw Davidson heading into one of the tunnels that led to the floor. He followed, caught Davidson's arm, said, "Hey." Davidson spun around, threw off Jack's hand. His eyes were like chips of obsidian. "I'd rather not talk to you, Mr. Braun." Jack started to retreat. He could feel the color draining out of his face. He took a grip on his nerves and stepped forward. "I want to talk to you, Harstein," he said. "We've got almost 40 years to catch up on." Harstein took a step backward and clutched at his heart. Jack felt a surge of terror. Maybe he'd just given the old geezer a heart attack. He reached out to hold Harstein upright, but the man coldly knocked Jack's hands away, then turned partly away and leaned on the wall. "If it be now," he murmured, "'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come." "Readiness is all," said Jack, completing the quote. He'd played Laertes in high school. Harstein looked sharply at Jack. "All these years, and you discover me. It's appropriate somehow." "If you say so." "Why are we having a conversation, unless you mean to blow the whistle on me?" Jack took a long breath. "I'm not blowing the whistle on anybody, David," he said. The actor's face was contemptuous. "An interesting step out of character." "You're the expert on character." "I'm the expert on prison, too. I spent 3 years there." "I didn't send you to prison, David," Jack said. "They sent you away before I ever testified." "Another interesting distinction," Davidson shrugged. "However, if it serves to salve your conscience." Tears stung Jack's eyes. He sagged against the wall. He couldn't use the defense he'd used on Hiram. Harstein had been there. He hadn't broken, and that's why they'd sent him to prison. And what had happened to Blythe had been far worse. It was as if Harstein had picked the thought out of his head. "I went to see Blythe right after I got out of prison, November 1953. I talked my way past the orderlies. I even went into her cell. I told her everything was going to be all right. I told her she was well. She wasn't. 3 weeks later, she was dead." "I'm sorry," Jack said. "Sorry," Harstein seemed to taste the word, rolling it about in his mouth, so easy to say, yet having so little effect. "We can make our lives sublime, and departing, leave behind us footprints in the sands of time." His eyes met Jack's. "A wind came up, Jack, and it blew away our footprints." He stared at Jack for a long time, an implacable look from which all emotions had been leached. Leave me alone, Jack. I never want to see you again. David Harstein turned and walked away. Jack slid slowly down the wall, terror and remorse shuddering through his body. It was at least 5 minutes before he got control of himself. When he stood up, he had huge sweat stains under his arms. Delegates passing through the tunnel looked at him with pity or disgust, assuming he was drunk. They were wrong. He was sober, perfectly sober. He had been so terrified he'd burned every ounce of alcohol in his system. Jack stepped back into the auditorium just as Jim Wright announced the latest delegate totals. Hartman's total was going into the sewer.
7 p.m. The hotel concourses were nearly deserted. Most of the people were watching the main event over on the convention floor. Spectre walked into the snack bar, a bottle of Jack Black tucked under his arm. He'd slept most of the day away, had to get something to eat. The Marriott restaurants were out of the question. After the fight with Golden Boy, there were sure to be people looking for him. But he was weak from hunger, and he had to get something. He wandered around the aisles of junk food and souvenirs, picking out a couple of candy bars, a can of cashews, some sausage sticks. A young black man was behind the register, staring at a small black-and-white television. Spectre set his stuff on the counter and peeled off a bill. "Be right with you, mister," said the clerk. "They're supposed to show Tachyon's hand exploding after these commercials. Missed it live. Damn, I bet that was something to see. Did you catch it?" "Tachyon's hand blew up? What the hell are you talking about?" "You've been by the pool all day or what?" said the clerk, shaking his head. "Some ugly little dude shook the doctor's hand and blew it clean off. They say..." "Wait a second. Here we go." He turned the television around so Spectre could see too. The video was in slow motion. Tachyon was working the crowd, shaking hands. "Who gets them?" Spectre asked. "Some little hunchback. See, there he is." Spectre opened his mouth, shut it. He was the same little twerp who'd been on the flight down with him. The hunchback took Tachyon's hand, and blood went everywhere. The cameraman was jostled by the panicked crowd, and the video ended. "Is he still alive?" Spectre had always wanted Tachyon dead, but found himself hoping for the best. After all, killing Tachyon was something he planned to do himself someday. "So far..." The clerk turned the television off and rang Spectre up. "I guess he's tougher than he looks." He sacked the junk food and handed it over with Spectre's change. "You don't go shaking hands with the devil, mister." "It's a bit too late for that," Spectre thought, smiling. He pocketed his change and headed back to the room.
"Hey, Jack. What is it, S.A.? Orders from Devon." "Yeah." Jack spoke without enthusiasm. He was hiding from interviews in the middle of what remained of his loyal delegates. The disloyal ones, a third of the total, were off caucusing with their new managers. "After the recess," Rodriguez said, "the Jackson camp is going to move to suspend the rules of the convention in order to let Jesse speak. We're supposed to vote in favor." Jack looked at Rodriguez in surprise. "We can't let a candidate speak. Hell, they'll all wanna." "News is, Jackson's gonna drop out." Rodriguez smiled and tapped his nose. "I smell something, Jack. Bet you Jackson's cut a deal with the boss. Bet you he's gonna be Veep." Jack's mind worked through the idea. He hadn't been in charge of his own delegation since he'd gone off the balcony on Thursday. It was Rodriguez who had been riding herd on California and voting Jack's proxy for Hartman. He had to respect Rodriguez's instincts here. As for the Hartman-Jackson ticket, why not? It was the same deal that Roosevelt and Garner had cut in 32, during the last stalled Democratic convention. "Our totals and Jesse's," he said, "are they..." "Not enough. Jesse's people are working on Dukakis now." Barnett will have to smell something. Or Fleur, he thought. Fleur had the sharper nose. Maybe, Jack thought, it was Fleur who was the secret ace, not Barnett. He wondered if Fleur had been in the military. After this morning, Rodriguez being tactful, there's no approaching them. Someone talked to Fleur, what's her name? She says no, doesn't even want to talk about it. Jack rose to his feet, scowling toward the massive battleship prow of the podium as Jim Wright called the convention to order and announced there would be another ballot. The damn vote would take forever. The managers had totally lost control of the delegates, and each delegation would have to be polled man by man. The move to suspend the convention rules would come after the vote total was announced, and then that would have to be voted on. God, how long could this go on? Fuck! Fuck! Rodriguez was shouting into his cellular phone. He slammed the thing into its cradle, then looked at Jack. Dukakis will go along with it. He hasn't got anything to lose, and maybe he can pick up some of Jackson's delegates. But we can't change the rules without Barnett. We need a three-quarters vote. This sucks, S.A. Barnett's going over the top if this Jackson stunt doesn't work. Rodriguez took a breath. Okay, here's what Devon wants. We're going to start spreading the rumor that Jackson is dropping out, that all he wants to do is address the convention and make a plea on behalf of his constituency. Nobody's calling the shots with his individual delegates anymore. Maybe Barnett's troops won't pay attention when he tells them to vote no. Maybe. Rodriguez shrugged. The whole scheme's a maybe. Jack felt his hands balling by his sides. There had to be some way to repair things. Some way to repair the damage that the assassin aces had done. Hell, that Jack had done. He remembered Longshoreman dancing on a countertop. David Harstein, he thought wildly. Get Harstein on the platform. Use him to influence the entire convention to nominate Hartman by acclamation. No. Stupid. Everyone would notice. People watching on TV would wonder how come they weren't as enthusiastic as the people at the convention. And the air conditioning might blow Harstein's pheromones away. Harstein's power was subtle. It had to be used subtly. He could only influence a few people at a time. Maybe, Jack thought, a few important people. Maybe Barnett's campaign manager. Jack thought of Fleur dancing on tabletops, flinging her underwear into the Omni atrium, calling Leo Barnett on the phone to tell him how good Tachyon was in bed. Jack gloried in this picture for a moment, before the whole thing fell apart. David Harstein hated his guts. Who was he to make plans for the man? The hell with that. Harstein wanted Hartman elected, right? If nothing else, Jack could resort to blackmail. He knew Harstein was a secret ace. He could threaten to reveal it. He thought of himself weeping in the tunnel, and his stomach turned over. Jim Wright read Alabama's delegate total. All for Barnett. That decided it. Jack was moving, walking from California to New York, across the massive front of the podium. Harstein was seated in the bleachers, watching his daughter address the New York delegation. He looked both sad and proud. Jack slapped Harstein on the shoulder and pinned him to his seat. The actor's eyes were veiled, cautious, watching. I thought we had reached an understanding. You leave me alone, I leave you alone. Jack spoke quickly. Listen, it's important. In a few minutes, there's going to be a motion to suspend the rules of the convention in order to let Jackson speak. He's going to withdraw and give his support to our man. Good for Greg Hartman, scowling. What's that got to do with me? The vote has to be damn near unanimous. Barnett has enough votes to block us. I figure we can talk to Fleur van Rensselaer and make her change her mind. We? The pointed emphasis made Jack want to melt into the ground. Is this your plan, or have you told Hartman about me? Jack shook his head. He was trying not to cringe. Nobody knows but me. I won't say anything, but you've got to help me. Harstein rubbed warily at his forehead. And you expect me to talk my way into Barnett's headquarters and change everybody's mind? He seemed almost to be talking to himself. What year do you think this is? 1947? This sort of thing didn't work then, and it isn't going to work now. He was right. It was so obvious. How could Jack have been so stupid? Jack caught himself just on the point of shrugging and walking away. Harstein's pheromones had already got Jack agreeing with him. What did he mean, it didn't work then? David had talked Franco right off his throne. Still, when he spoke, he didn't sound convincing, even to himself. If we don't do this, Barnett's gonna win. This will all be for nothing. Sweat poured down Jack's face. He felt as if his heart was going to explode any second. All we have to do is change one mind. Fleur's. Davidson looked away, thinking. Jack took a desperate lungful of air, tried to calm his trembling limbs. I've made a life, Davidson said. I've got a family. I can't risk them. My counterfeit identity won't stand up to thorough investigation. He looked at Jack. I'm an old man. I don't do that sort of thing anymore. Maybe it should never have been done. Surprise sang in Jack's veins. He wants my understanding, he thought. You're doing that sort of thing now, Jack said. You wouldn't be here if you weren't trying to influence people. Jack, you still don't get it, do you? I can't help but influence people. I can't turn my power on or off. That's why I'm not a delegate. That's why I keep to myself. What right have I got to replace a man's opinion with mine? Is mine necessarily any better than his? Harstein shook his head. Jack fought against the ferocious urge to just agree with Harstein and walk away. Our opinions, he said, fighting to get every word out, are one hell of a lot better than the ravings of a man who threatens us. Your daughter. He pointed at her and remembered her name, Sheila. Sheila has the wild card. You've got a full dose. Both chromosomes. And even if your wife didn't have the virus, you couldn't help but give Sheila a latent. And if she marries someone with another latent, their kids could end up with a full wild card. Harstein said nothing. His eyes traveled to where his daughter stood among the other delegates. Sheila was looking back, her face worried. She knew, then, of her father's identity, guessed that Jack knew as well. Do you know what will happen to them if Barnett becomes president? Jack went on. They'll be confined to a nice hospital in some remote location, a hospital with a razor wire fence, and you won't have grandchildren. Barnett'll see to that. Harstein turned to Jack. The ice had returned. Kindly don't mention my daughters again. Don't you ever use that line of argument with me. You don't give a damn for them. Or me. Harstein fell silent. Looked at his daughters again. Spoke softly. We have seen the best of our time. Machinations, hollowness, treachery, and all ruinous disorders follow us disquietly to our graves. He looked at Jack. That was an unfair argument. But it convinced me. I will do what I can. He hesitated. I'm a little surprised. I thought you'd threaten to expose me. I'm glad to see I was wrong. That's always an option, Jack thought, but didn't say it. He didn't mind developing a reputation for decency for a change. It took only a minute to walk from the Omni complex to the Omni hotel next door. It was almost 10 minutes before Jack and Harstein could get an elevator to Barnett's headquarters. A lot of Barnett's people were around. There was a lot of staring. Jack ignored them and did a lot of thinking. Their convention IDs were enough to get them into the hotel and probably into the operations room. Security would be greatest around the candidate, and Barnett's room was on another floor. Jack's problem would be staying in the operations room long enough to get next to Fleur and let Harstein's pheromones do their work. Harstein's mention of blackmail had set Jack's mind working. While waiting for the elevator, Jack got some hotel stationery from the front desk and penned a note, then wrote Fleur van Rensselaer on the back. The note said, I need 5 minutes of your time. If I don't get it, the world and Reverend Barnett will find out about your sins of the flesh with Tachyon. He considered signing it Yours in Christ, Jack Braun, but decided that might be pushing things a little far. The elevator doors opened and Jack stepped inside, surprising the hell out of 2 Barnett supporters of the little blue-haired lady variety. Jack smiled politely as he entered and pressed the button for Barnett HQ. People waiting for the elevators did a lot of double takes as Jack stepped out, but nobody stopped him as he headed for the operations center. He walked right through the door, past a lot of young women on telephone banks, and failed to see any sign of Fleur. He grinned at the nearest worker. Where's the boss lady? He said. The girl stared. She was maybe 17. Cute in an unformed blonde way. Her glasses slid down her nose. Her name, according to her name tag, was Beverly. Aye, she said. You're... Harstein bent close to her and said, Go ahead. You can tell him. He smiled reassuringly. Ah. Harstein's expression was gentle. It's really all right, Beverly. He said, Mr. Braun's here on business, and I'm just tagging along. Beverly pointed with a pencil. I think Miss Van Rensselaer is in her office, she said. 2 doors down, 718. Thank you. The room was beginning to buzz with alarm. People were glaring at Jack and dialing phones. He smiled at them all reassuringly, gave them a wave, and left. Harstein followed. I hope it's a small room, Harstein said. You have no idea what the advent of air conditioning has done to my power. Heads poked from the door as Jack strolled to 718 and knocked. He could hear televisions and a phone ringing in the room. The phone cut off, and he heard steps coming to the door. It opened. A silver-haired man stood there, his eyes widening in shock, then narrowing in anger. He flushed. Yes? Fleur's voice on the phone. I guess he's here. Thank you, Veronica. You are not welcome here, the silver-haired man said. I'd like to see Miss Van Rensselaer, Jack said. The man tried to slam the door. Jack held it open with his hand. Please, he said. The door jerked open. Fleur looked at Jack from over the rims of square-cut reading glasses. Her mouth was a grim slash. Two other men stood behind her, in various uneasy postures. Televisions turned to various networks babbled along one wall. I don't think we have anything to talk about, Mr. Braun, she said. We do, Jack said. I'd like to apologize for a start. Fine, you've done that, Fleur said. She started to close the door. I'd like to speak to you for just a few moments. I'm busy. You may write for an appointment after the convention. The door closed to a few inches, and again Jack stopped it. Jack produced the envelope from his pocket. Okay, he said. Here's my appointment request. I'd like you to read it now. He lightly tossed the envelope inside and let Fleur close the door. He looked down the corridor to see two security men walking toward him, doubtless summoned by the phone ladies. Their expressions, in the face of a man who used to throw Russian tanks off Korean mountainsides, lacked confidence. Ugh, the nearest one said. Jack grinned at them. No problem, officers. I'll be leaving as soon as Miss Van Rensselaer gives me an appointment. They looked at each other, then decided to wait. We were told there was a problem, one of them said. Problem? No problem. The guards did not seem reassured. The door opened. 5 minutes, said Fleur, and that's all you get. She turned to the men in the suite with her. Reverend Pickens, Mr. Smart, Mr. Johnson, I hope you'll excuse me. Something's come up. The men filed out past Jack, offering mixed distrust and relief. Jack stepped into the room, and Harstein followed. Who's this man? Fleur said. I didn't agree to see him. Josh Davidson, madam. Harstein gave a stage bow, sweeping low. He's an old friend of the family. He's with me. He can wait outside. Madam, I will not interfere in your business, Harstein said. An old fellow like me finds it hard to wait in cold air-conditioned corridors. I won't be any harm. Have I not a moist eye, a dry hand, a yellow cheek, a white beard, a decreasing leg, an increasing belly? I am an object of pity. Pray do not scorn and cast me out. Fleur looked at him. The corners of her mouth twitched in reluctant amusement. This is against my better judgment, she said. But you can stay. Fortunately, her better judgment did not prevail. 9 p.m. The Jackson motion came up, was seconded, passed overwhelmingly. Harstein kissed Fleur's hand goodbye, and he and Jack made their way to the elevators. We may have just made a president, Jack said. He felt pleasantly drunk, as if on champagne. Harstein just kept walking for the elevator. Hey, we won. Things without all remedy should be without regard, said Harstein. What's done is done. He looked at Jack, and so too are we done. Never speak to me again, Jack. Never come near me or my family. I'm warning you. Jack's blood turned chill. Whatever you say, he said. He let Harstein take the first elevator by himself.
Sarah had the proper plastic smile molded into her face when he stepped off the people mover with his shiny new travel bag slung over the shoulder of his leisure suit. She looped her arms around his neck and hugged him with a fervor that surprised her. Uncle George! She squealed. Oh, it's so good to see you! Polyakov hugged her and patted her shoulder. Not so shrill, child. Eardrums are brittle things at my age. Why didn't you meet me at the gate? He took her arm and steered her into the traffic streaming toward the escalators that led to the baggage carousels. They're not letting anybody but passengers with tickets into the boarding area. Are you sure it's safe to just come in openly like this? Smiling, to all appearance chattering happily to the elderly relative she'd just been reunited with, She nodded toward the security checkpoint where the passengers were filing through the metal detectors like cows through the chute for their appointment with the hammer. A pair of young men stood to one side, eyeing the crowd as discreetly as anybody that beefy could. Their suits were dark and tight under the left armpits. A little flesh-tone wire trailed from each man's ear. He smiled.
They're looking for dangerous Russian spies trying to get out of Atlanta, not back in.
But the airport,
I could have taken a bus, I grant, especially since the good doctor's friend happened to transport me to the Port Authority in New York City.
At the mention of Tachyon, Sarah's face twisted briefly, as if she'd stepped on a tack.
But that would have been too slow. And anyway, they're doubtless watching the bus terminals as well. Also, I detest buses.
They were on the moving stair now. You heard what happened? Sarah asked.
It was all over the televisions that infest the passenger waiting areas in LaGuardia. How lonely your capitalist lives must be, that you use your enormous production to surround yourselves so completely with synthetic company. An ace assassin making an attempt on the life of a potential presidential nominee, especially one as controversial and ethnic as Jackson. It's all raised quite the sensation.
That was how the police and media saw it, of course. The hunchbacked kid in leather had been trying to hit Jackson, and Dr. Tachyon had gotten in the way.
How is it with Tachyon?
The Soviet asked. She stumbled a little coming off the escalator. The hand that had caressed her, touched her last night as so few men had, was cooked meat and splintered bone now. The way that made her feel... The way it made her feel was something she would not confront now. Nothing matters, she told herself, but staying alive long enough to see Andy avenged.
The doctor, he prodded gently. How is he?
He's in what they call stable condition. They had to amputate, but he's recovering well. They have him in some hospital. The media aren't saying which one. The police have tied his assailant to Ricky's murder and the fight with Jack Braun Thursday night. They know he can walk through walls. Lieutenant Herlihy has finally had to bite the bullet and admit he's got an ace killer on the loose. Not just a killer, but a political assassin, and he's stalking the convention. She didn't try to keep the bitter satisfaction from her voice. If only the police had listened to me, she thought, though what they could have done, even if they had, was none too clear. At least it would have meant somebody thought she was more than a hysterical woman who'd been spurned by her love object. Somebody other than the man who called himself George Steele. They walked toward the sliding robot doors to the humid outside. Sarah had a car in the lot that she'd rented under an assumed name. Now, of course, Atlanta's finest were falling all over themselves with eagerness to talk to her. Even if she'd had anything more to say to them, she had no illusions about their ability to protect her from that pale-eyed youth who hummed as he killed. Polyakov shook his head.
The bad times are coming for wild cards in this country. Whatever we do here, that is true, I'm afraid. But it makes it that much more imperative we stop the madman Hartman. You might have to take a more active role.
She stopped dead in the middle of the doors, which spasmed open and shut in mechanical frenzy. No! I've already told you. I can't do that. He took her by the arm and urged her out to the sidewalk. Diesel fumes and cabbies assailed them. They ignored both.
Someone has to. Tachyon may not be able.
Why not you? You're a killer ace, too. Why not use your power? He glanced around without moving his head. No one was nearby.
My. Our goal is to prevent World War III. How well would that end be served if an American presidential candidate was killed by a KGB ace?
That was his goal. She turned and darted across the street, avoiding being run down more by luck than by design. He followed more cautiously. He was puffing slightly when he caught up in the short-term parking.
It was clever of you to check your answering machine.
He was trying to gentle her like he would a frightened animal. She didn't care. Clever of you to leave a message saying where you were coming in and when. She opened the driver's door of the rose-gray rental Corolla and slid in.
That's my business,
he said as she leaned across to unlock his door. He opened the rear door and put his bag in back.
I'm a professional spy. I'm paid to think of such things.
Being a spy is not so much different from being a journalist, she said. Just ask General Westmoreland. She turned the key with a savage twist and started the car.
My right and my privilege to stand here, said Jesse Jackson, has been won in my lifetime, by the blood and the sweat of the innocent. From Jack's point of view, the candidate's figure was tiny, dwarfed by the massive white podium, but his ringing orator's voice filled the air. Jack heard the restless delegates grow hushed, expectant. Everyone, whether they liked Jackson or not, knew this was going to be important. I stand as a testament to the struggles of those who have gone before, as a legacy for those who will come after, as a tribute to the endurance, the patience, the courage of our forefathers and mothers, as an assurance that their prayers are being answered, their work has not been in vain, and hope is eternal. Those who have gone before. Jack thought about Earl, standing in his aviator's jacket on that platform, his baritone voice rolling out of the speakers. It should have been Earl there, he thought, and years ago. America is not one blanket, woven from one thread, one color, one cloth. When I was a child growing up in Greenville, South Carolina, and Grandmama could not afford a blanket, she didn't complain, and we didn't freeze. Instead, she took pieces of old cloth, patches, wool, silk, gabardine, crocker sack. Only patches, barely good enough to wipe off your shoes with. But they didn't stay that way very long. With sturdy hands and a strong cord, she sewed them together into a quilt, a thing of beauty and power and culture. Now, Democrats, we must build such a quilt. Farmers, you seek fair prices, and you are right. But you cannot stand alone. Your patch isn't big enough. Workers, you fight for fair wages. You are right. But your patch of labor is not big enough. Jokers, you seek fair treatment, civil rights, a medical system sensitive to your needs. But your patch is not big enough. Years ago, in voice and diction lessons courtesy of Louis B. Mayer, Jack had learned the tricks of the rhetorician. He knew why preachers like Jackson and Barnett used those long cadences, those rhythmic, crafted emphases. Jack knew that the long sentences, the rhythms, could put the audience into a mild hypnotic trance, could make them more susceptible to the preacher's message. What if it had been Barnett standing here? Jack wondered. What message would be rolling forth in those glittering images, those seductive rhythms? Don't despair, Jackson shouted. Be as wise as my grandmama. Pull the patches and pieces together, bound by a common thread. When we form a great quilt of unity and common ground, we'll have the power to bring about health care and housing and jobs and education and hope. When I look out at this convention, I see the face of America, red, yellow, brown, black, and white, the real patchwork quilt that is our nation, the Rainbow Coalition. But we have not yet come together. No strong hand has yet bound us together with a strong cord. I address you tonight to tell you the name of the man who will unite our patches into something that will keep America from turning cold in this long, freezing night of Reaganomics. There was a murmur among the delegates. Not all, including Jackson's own followers, had been told this was a resignation speech. Some of them had just gotten their first clue. His foreparents came to America on immigrant ships, Jackson said. A friend of mine, desperately wounded this afternoon as he stood beside me, came to this planet on a spaceship. Mine came to America on slave ships. But whatever the original ships, we are in the same boat tonight. From quilts, then to boats, there was applause, whistles, a constant murmur. A woman was on her feet in the Illinois delegation. No, Jesse! This convention has been threatening to sink the boat. Jackson continued. We have been running from one end of the boat to the other, from the progressive end to the conservative end, from the right side of the boat to the left side, and the boat may turn over. And Democrats, we may sink. It is time, therefore, to give the rudder to someone who can steer it safely to harbor. Tonight I salute this man. He has run a well-managed and a dignified campaign. No matter how tired or how tried, he always resisted the temptation to stoop to demagoguery. I have watched a good mind, fast at work, with steel nerves, guiding his campaign out of the crowded field without appeal to the worst in us. I have watched his perspective grow as his environment has expanded. I have seen his toughness and tenacity, knew his commitment to public service. Jackson paused, his intent eyes searching the convention, his hands grasping the platform, wondering, maybe, what his new role as Kingmaker Jesse might bring. I urge the convention to unite behind this man, this new captain. I urge everyone here, all the delegates, my own not excepted, to vote for a new captain before our boat turns over and we sink for another 4 years. The name of the captain... Silence. Jack could hear his own heart beating. Senator, Jackson said. Jack looked at Rodriguez in the next seat. Greg, he said, in unison with Jackson. Rodriguez looked back. There was wild joy in his eyes. Hartman, he roared, along with Jack and Jesse and the crowd. And suddenly, everyone went mad. Mad for Greg Hartman.
Spectre sat on the carpeted floor in front of the television. He had the volume turned way down. Nobody was supposed to be in 1019, and he didn't want people snooping around this room, too. He'd bought a can of cashews and a pint of whiskey downstairs, and had put away most of both during the balloting. He'd hoped that Hartman would lose. A candidate who'd washed out wasn't likely to have the same kind of tight security as the nominee. As usual, things had gone all wrong. The delegates were chanting, Hartman, 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 until the name itself pissed him off. Jesse Jackson had pulled out of the race for some reason. All the commentators were talking about some kind of behind-the-scenes deal. In any case, Hartman had gone over the top on the next ballot. Signs for each state were waving back and forth. There were balloons, confetti, and endless boring speeches. Golden Boy was still alive. That made Spectre even more nervous than he'd been before. Braun got a good enough look at him for an ID. The Judas Ace had looked plastered or sick when the TV cameras had shown him. Spectre sighed. Usually when he killed them, they stayed dead. Tomorrow he'd concentrate on finding a way to get at Hartman. Right now, he didn't have the first idea how he'd go about it. But the senator wasn't leaving Atlanta alive. Of course, Spectre might not either. He didn't bother trying to tell himself that there were some things worse than death. He knew better. If he could find someone to help him, someone powerful, he might actually walk away in one piece. And he knew one person who might be inclined to help. It was a big risk, but what the fuck? He turned off the TV, curled up into a ball around the almost empty bottle, and tried to get to sleep.
Chapter 7. Sunday, July 24th, 1988. 7 a.m. With one cheap towel wrapped around her dripping body from breast to thighs, and another wound around her hair, Sarah emerged from the bathroom in a breath of steam. Motion was effort. She had rigor mortis to the depths of her soul. We can't rely on Tachyon anymore. She forced her words out like lumps of plasticine through a window screen. They weren't a question. The man who called himself George Steele sat on the bed in trousers and undershirt, looking down at the backs of his hands. They were hairy, like his shoulders. He raised his head.
We cannot.
You know the plan we discussed earlier? His eyes narrowed.
Yes.
I'll do it. She turned and went back into the bathroom to dry her hair.
9 a.m. Hospitals were tasty, and Puppet Man was getting hungry. Greg leaned away from the compact portable 3 and rubbed his eyes. He typed a quick message. Tony, I'm taking a break. The speech looks good, and I'm sending my last edit. I'll leave the computer on and pick up the draft when I get back. Thanks. He sent the file via modem to Calderone's portable and rubbed his eyes. Tired, love? Ellen smiled at him from her hospital bed, half asleep herself. I think the next president of the United States ought to get some sleep. You had a long night last night, and Jack tells me you and Jesse stayed up till all hours planning the campaign. It was a glorious night, Ellen. Jesse's speech was a wonder. I'm sorry you weren't there. None of it was possible without you. She smiled at that, tinged with sadness. She was still pale, her skin almost translucent, and her eyes were puffy and dark. The death of their child had marked her more permanently than he had thought possible. I'm coming to hear your speech tonight. Nothing could stop me. Kiss me, next president of the United States. Picked up on that phrase, have we? After last night's roll call, the great state of New York cast all its votes for the next president of the United States, Greg Hartman. How many states are there? She held her arms out. Greg leaned over the bed and kissed her softly on the lips. Puppet Man nudged at him. Give her to me. No, leave her alone. We've put her through enough. Getting sentimental, are we? The power mocked him, but didn't seem inclined to argue. Then let's go elsewhere. I'm hungry. Greg hugged Ellen. Listen, he said. I'm going to take a short walk. Thought I might see some of the patients, shake a few hands. Campaigning already, Ellen gave a mock sigh. Mr. Next President of the United States. Get used to it, love. You'll get tired of handshaking before it's all over, Greg. He gave her a strange grin. I doubt it, he said. Inside, Puppet Man echoed him.
11 a.m. Spectre woke up groggy. There was a metallic taste in his mouth and he hurt all over. All his stuff was at the motel, so he couldn't shave or brush his teeth. He'd have to stop by there and clean up before making his visit. He sat on the corner of the bed and rubbed the grit from his eyes. He picked up the phone book and thumbed through until he came to hospitals. He found the one Tony was in, hesitated for a moment, then punched in the numbers. Tony Calderone, please, he said to the switchboard operator. It rang several times before being answered. Calderone? Yeah, this is Jim. I wanted to explain about the other day. Right. Colin said you were up in my room. Hope you didn't get mugged again. Tony sounded glad to hear from him. Nothing like that. Got sidetracked with business is all. Spectre wanted to tell him everything, but knew Tony wouldn't believe it. He was too committed. I just wanted you to know I was all right. Yeah, I was a little worried. Got the speech done. Best thing I ever wrote. Hope you get a chance to catch it. Tony paused. You sure nothing's wrong? Nothing getting back to Jersey won't cure. Spectre twisted the phone cord. It was really great seeing you again. I mean that. We'll do it again sooner than you think. In Washington. Tony sounded completely confident. Right. Spectre knew that by the end of the day, Tony would hate his guts forever. So much for his one friend. But he knew he couldn't walk away now. Look, I have to get moving. Still got a thing or two to take care of before I go. Okay. Well, after things get settled, you give me a call. In the meantime, look after yourself. So long. Spectre set the phone lightly in its cradle. He couldn't let this sentimental crap take away his edge. He was going to need it. Spectre put the whiskey bottle in his coat pocket. He gave the room a slow look before leaving. He knew he wouldn't be coming back.
12 noon. Jack hadn't found Blaze on any of his intermittent searches, and he decided it was time to head for the hospital and tell Tachyon that Blaze was gone. Hell, the kid would probably be right by his granddad's bedside. Hartman supporters were wandering about the Marriott lobby in various attitudes of inebriation or exhaustion. Yellow warning tape fluttered around the hole that Jack had driven into the floor. Jack saw the pert waitress he'd noticed before and gave her a wink. She grinned at him. He was sufficiently preoccupied with notions concerning the waitress that he didn't see Hiram until he almost tripped over the huge suitcase, almost a trunk, that the man had set next to him. Hiram seemed as surprised as Jack. The big man's eyes were wide in alarm. Maybe the suitcase contained something valuable. Hiram had a man with him, a thin joker with a little mustache and webs of skin over hollow eye sockets. "Oh, sorry." Jack stepped around the suitcase. He looked up at Hiram. "Won't you be staying for the acceptance speech?" "Ah, no. I've stayed longer in Atlanta than I meant to, anyway." Hiram's eyes gazed at Jack out of bruised sockets. He was a mess, his hair awry, his collar open to reveal the sore on his neck. Maybe he'd slept in his suit. He took Jack's arm and led him away, out of earshot of the thin joker. "Actually, I've been wanting to speak to you." "I've been hoping to see you too," Jack ventured a smile. "I wanted to thank you for the other day. You maybe saved me from getting hurt, making me light that way." "I'm glad I was able to be of assistance." Hiram glanced over his shoulder at the Joker and gave a nervous smile. He turned back to Jack. "I wanted to tell you something," he said. His tone sent a little warning signal down Jack's spine. Whatever was coming, Jack knew he didn't really want to hear it. "Sure," he said. "I wanted to say that I understand now," Hiram said. His voice was leaden. "That you were right when you said that you didn't know till you've been tested." "Oh," said Jack. He didn't want to hear this confession. Whatever Jack was, whatever he'd done, he didn't want anyone else's sins rattling around in his own head. He had trouble enough coping with his own. "When I was attacking you the other day," Hiram went on, "I was really attacking myself. I was trying to deny my own betrayals." Yeah, Jack just wanted Hiram and his soap opera to leave. What kind of betrayal could someone like Hiram pull off anyway? Buy second-rate cuts of veal for his restaurant? Hiram looked at him, eyes bright, as if he was expecting some kind of wisdom from Jack, some way to handle this burden of self-knowledge. Jack didn't have much to give. "You can't change the past, Hiram," Jack said. "You can maybe make the future a little better. We've done that, I think, with what we've done the last week." "Hiram!" The Joker was looking at them with his blank eye sockets. Jack had the uneasy feeling he was being scrutinized. "It's time to go." "Yes, of course." Hiram was panting for breath, as if the conversation had somehow exhausted him. "See you around, maybe," Jack said. Hiram turned without a word and headed back to pick up the suitcase. Either it held nothing, or Hiram had made it light. A giddy wave of paranoia struck Jack at the sight of Hiram hefting the huge suitcase and heading for the big revolving doors. Suppose Blaze. But no, the suitcase was big, Jack realized, but not big enough to hold a teenage boy. The events of the last few days had made him jumpy.
1 p.m. Even with the medication, Puppet Man could feel Tony Calderone's pain. It tasted spicy. He tweaked it just for the pleasure. Tony grimaced and jumped slightly in his bed, joggling the laptop on his food tray. His face went visibly pale. "You okay?" Greg asked, ignoring Puppet Man's interior laughter. "Just a twinge, Senator. No big deal." His denial was belied by the sweat on his forehead. Puppet Man giggled. "Now leave him alone. We have to work." "No problem, Greggy. It just feels so good to be free again. We've put it all together. It's all ours now." "I've been thinking about the speech, Senator," Tony was saying.
I think I've come up with the catchphrase we've been looking for. I was looking through all the old speeches. You remember what you said in Roosevelt Park when you declared that you were running? That brought back memories. It hadn't been long after that speech that he had had Kahina killed in front of Chrysalis and Downs to guarantee their silence about his ace. That certainly worked well, Greg thought ironically. But it did, Puppet Man insisted. It kept things quiet through the campaign. Tachyon found out too late. It's all taken care of now. I suppose. What phrase were you thinking of, Tony? Greg asked the speechwriter. Tony punched a key and read the words on the LCD screen. There are other masks than those Jokertown has made famous. Your own line, too, if I recall, and a good one. Behind that mask is an infection that's all too human. I want to rip the mask off and expose the true ugliness behind, the ugliness of hatred. Tony tapped the screen. That's a powerful image. I think it's time we built on it. Sounds fine to me. What have you got in mind? Well, I've been working along those lines since last night, and I've had another thought. Tony grinned, and Greg felt an upwelling of pulsing yellow. Tony was proud of this one. He pushed the laptop aside and sat up straighter in bed. His fingertips drummed on his thigh in excitement. What if we had everyone wearing masks? You, Jesse, everyone on stage, and all our delegates out in the audience. Jokers, aces, and gnats. Every last one masked so you can't tell the difference. Then when you hit the right line, Tony closed his eyes thinking, I don't know, something along the lines of, it's time for all of us to remove our masks, the masks of prejudice, of hatred, of intolerance, but stronger, much stronger, and with a lot of buildup. And just as you say it, boom, everyone rips off their mask and tosses it in the air. Greg chuckled. He turned the scene over in his mind. I like it. I think I like it a lot. It's hot. It's a guaranteed spot on every channel. Can you see it? All those masks in the air? Man, you talk about an image. It rivets the wild card issue in every voter's mind. And Bush is going to have a hell of a time getting drama like that at the Republican convention. Greg slapped the bedsheets and stood up. Well, run with it. You start working on this speech. I'll get together with Amy, John, and Devon and get this coordinated with our people. Tony, this is good. When you have a full draft, send it up to Ellen's room. I've got the modem on the compact set up. You got it, Senator, Tony grinned. The public's never going to forget what happens tonight, Tony. Get cracking. We don't have much time. Greg was grinning as he left the room. Tachyon was out of the picture, the nomination was wrapped up, and now the perfect image for the coming campaign.